Welcome to episode 43 of GBW. My name is Josh, and with me as always is Chris.
Hello, Josh.
Hi. I really wish I could come up with something different to say, but, you know, you're just saying what you say, right?
Well,
like, you're just introducing us, right?
You're welcoming us to...
Yeah.
To two hours of hanging out with our...
Welcome.
Our nerd asses.
Yeah, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy this evening's presentation. Tonight, we're going to talk about unsung monsters, also known as lesser-known monsters.
Well, these are just monsters that we like, but aren't like your typical monsters you always hear about.
Yeah, I had a little bit of difficulty with this topic just because I was like trying to go with like, are they lesser-known monsters? Is it a monster? I went with a lot of like monsters that made a big impression on me.
Yeah.
Like growing up and stuff. Because, and then I also thought, you know, like some of them, like, are they really lesser-known monsters? Or like, is a bigger monster, like a more known monster to us, really, it's still kind of a lesser-known monster to like a millennial. So.
Yeah, I kind of just went with ones I thought was cool that are in movies that are not really like hugely well-known.
We always go with what's cool, right? We both know what's
cool.
We both know what's cool. Yes. So that's why people are listening.
We're such trendsetters.
Yeah. Although, you know, if more people would listen to that vampire episode, they'd know some more cool vampire movies.
Yeah, I wonder, we were talking about this, and seriously, man, our top 10 vampires episode just ain't doing it for people. And, you know, we mentioned a lot of really...
Yeah, we're not talking about Lost Boys the whole time, guys.
Yeah, no. No, Josh just is talking about his inherent hatred of sax rock music.
Yes, I did it again this week on the Facebook page.
Yes, okay.
What did I bring up? Oh, that horrific cover of Pretty in Pink. Yeah, the version they do on the soundtrack. Oh, God,
oh, like are you talking like at the very beginning? Is that sax at the very beginning of that song?
The whole song is, yeah, there's sax going throughout, and then really? There's a sax solo at the end. It's
is
awful.
Is there really?
Yeah.
I've never really paid attention.
That shit wasn't on the album, like the real album.
I should listen to that, because I...
Did you listen to it?
No.
What's wrong with you? I said this is superior to the album version,
no.
You just didn't listen to it?
I meant I should listen to the saxophone version.
No, don't listen to the saxophone. It's terrible. But
there's something soothing about the sax.
Fuck.
Isaac Hayes likes sax.
Well, that's different.
That's different.
That's different. Like, horns are okay in soul music, but not in rock and roll.
All right.
Anyway.
Fair enough.
All right. Okay, let's talk about what we've been watching. Do you want to go first?
Sure, I guess so.
I'm gonna open the door a little bit because I'm a little hot.
Yeah, you're a lot hot, Josh.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyway, so you know, they do 99-cent rentals on PlayStation Network.
Oh, not, this is like the Dollarama.
This
the
is the new
world.
Dollarama for me, because remember I talked about Vendetta.
Yeah.
Well, this time I rented The Lazarus Effect.
Oh, yes.
And the reason I did this...
This is getting a lot of good press, though.
Okay. I kept hearing it being called Flatliners 2.
Right.
Like, simply because the story is about, like, some medical students who are working on this project that they learn how to bring the dead back to life.
Right.
So, you know, it's headed by... Mark Duplass and Olivia Wilde. They're a husband-wife... scientist duo, and they have a handful of students, and they're working on this project, and you know, they start with animals, obviously, because that's what all good scientists do, you know, they start with animals,
unless you're Kiefer Sutherland.
That's true. And then you know, Olivia Wilde's character has a tragic accident in the lab, and they decide at on the spur of the moment to use this machinery on her, which works successfully. But she's not the same lady she once was. She's almost like demon possessed, and she's out for blood.
Okay.
So that's like the basic of this movie. I actually kind of found it to be dull.
That doesn't sound like Flatliners.
I know it does. I think they were comparing it to Flatliners simply because it's about bringing somebody back from the dead.
Oh, so it's not really like Flatliners.
Well, like not. No, Very slender parallels.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they're remaking Flatliners now anyway, so whatever.
Don't get me started.
But
That's okay. I'm taking a new approach to remakes. It's cool.
It's cool because you don't have to watch it.
It's cool.
Okay. Well, anyway. So I just found it to be, you know, lots of jump scare attempts, which kind of annoy me.
Yeah.
And I didn't really learn anything about the characters. The movie's 83 minutes long and you learn nothing about the characters particularly.
Right.
And most of the time they're just trapped in this lab, you know, slowly eviscerated or whatever. And it's not really that gory. I'm making it sound better than it is. But I just found it to be kind of dull. No suspense. Like I found out it was written by one of the guys who wrote Shudder remake.
Yes.
And then the other guy wrote the new Fantastic Four movie.
So, okay.
So, you know, take from that what you want, because, you know, Shudder sucked and I've heard nothing but bad things about Fantastic Four.
Right.
So I just found it to be incredibly dull.
That's too bad.
And like, I hate it when horror movies have to resort to jump scares to try and, like, you know, draw you in. And there was a scene in here where one character, it involves a character sneaking into a locker. Very similar scene to a great 1987 sequel called Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2.
Right. Okay.
But done way better in Prom Night 2.
Right.
I'm not going to tell you what it is, but if you've seen Prom Night 2, you know what I'm talking about.
Right.
So that's Lazarus Effect.
We'll kick it off
with a low endorsement.
All right.
Don't worry. There's one more that's not a ringing endorsement either. So, and it's not going to be like that one week, man. There is a couple things I did like that I'm going to talk about.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Well, I'm going to start off with my wrapping up of the I Spit on Your Grave franchise.
Oh, you finally got up enough balls to watch it, did you?
I Spit on Your Grave 3, Vengeance is Mine. Yes, I did. So this was made in 2015, directed by R.D. Brownstein. who hasn't really done much other than a movie called 100 Degrees Below Zero, I think, for The Asylum. Oh. So it's too bad because the director of the first two, the remake and the sequel to the remake, I thought he did a pretty good job.
That's that Stephen Monroe guy?
Stephen Monroe, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Stephen C. Monroe, I believe.
R.
Oh, Stephen R. Monroe, right? Oh.
Well. Nerds!
All right, so this one... This took the franchise in a different direction. So it wasn't just rape revenge like we're used to with these types of movies. This one was about Angela from the first movie. She comes back in this and she's all fucked. She's really fucked up. She's really messed up, very clearly messed up. She has like weird little fantasies about killing basically every man she runs into. And she's getting psychiatric treatment and she's encouraged to join a support group. So off she goes and joins a support group and she meets this punk chick named Marla, who's played by Michael Landon's daughter, Jennifer, who didn't really come across well as a punk chick. Like, I just wasn't buying her character. And then it gets really preachy from here. Like, there's a lot of scenes of like them in the support group. And then it's like the punk chick and Angela, like going out for beers and talking about how men are fucked up. And I felt like I was watching a really preachy,
a Lifetime movie.
Yeah. Like it felt weird. So I wasn't too digging it. Then the two of them, I guess, take things a step further than their verbal anger and they beat up this pedophile guy. And then that sort of empowers them that they can make a difference because the pedophile's like molesting this girl who's in their support group. So then the next time they go to their group, the girl's all happy and they're like, "Oh, we've made a difference." Anyway, next thing you know, Marla sort of vanishes from the movie and we're back to Angela, who's pretty crazy.
What happens to Marla?
Well, I guess it doesn't really matter. She gets whacked. She gets killed by her boyfriend.
Oh, okay.
We don't see it, though.
Okay.
But she just gets killed. So this kind of sets Angela off and on this crazy, she goes totally nutso, and she goes like all Death Wish. So it's not like, so nothing's happened to her, but something happened to this other woman. And then Angela goes like Paul Kersey. And she like kind of like sexes herself up and like kind of lures guys in and kills them. And again, it just kind of, the whole thing just didn't work. It didn't work like the other two did.
Okay, like, so this is a character from the first movie.
Yes.
Now,
and the first movie is quite good.
In the first, in the original remake, it's rape revenge. So she gets raped in that first movie.
In the forest, yeah.
So if she's a rape victim, why is she going to go tart herself up? That just does not seem to fit with the MO of someone who's gone through a traumatic event like that.
Yeah, because she was trying to, because basically, like, she's going after Marla's boyfriend who killed her, right?
Right.
So they say. So she's like vigilante style.
Yeah, but wouldn't she be damaged from the original movie still? Like,
yeah, like it's just really awkward, and it just doesn't fit the character. Like, it just doesn't.
That's what I mean. It seems like too much of a shift in.
Yeah, it didn't feel right. But the one thing I will, psychiatrist angle, like, she's, because she keeps going to get therapy, and there's all these like, you know, talks, and she's talking, you know, pretty nihilistic, and she's, you know, like, everyone's out for something, everyone uses everyone and all this, and the psychiatrist like, that's pretty downbeat, you know, and stuff like that. And again, it just really felt like forced. Like, I just was kind of like, why are we watching this whole angle? And so I don't know why they went in this direction. I mean, because, you know, especially a series like this, like, you're kind of expecting, it's kind of like a brutal, like, Friday the 13th. You're in it for the kills, right? And because that's what the other two were patterned on as well. Like, when she goes after the guys in both the other two movies, or, you know, it's some pretty good shit. It's like a Saw movie or something, right?
Right.
But this one, there was way too much talking. There was actually only two real kills in this movie. But, boy, they were good. So I am going to spoil the one just because it was just so...
Okay, so if you have any interest in I Spit, yeah, on Your Grave 3... Yeah, just turn off for
like a minute.
Yeah.
But this one, and she like, she goes to give this guy a blowjob, and she like, you see it in her mouth, like the tip. Okay. And then she takes a knife and stabs up through the penis and then starts sawing as it's in her mouth. It was something I've never seen. So
were you cringing?
I wasn't cringing like I thought I would be, but thinking about it, yeah, it really makes me cringe. But that was pretty epic. I'll give it that. That was probably the most epic kill of this whole series. But other than that, there was another one that, yeah, again, I was a little afraid to watch this because I had heard about these two scenes, but they weren't nearly as affecting as I thought they'd be. But they were pretty good. It was a pretty good payoff. But I don't know if it was worth watching this whole movie. So the only other thing that was really weird about this movie was Doug McKeon was in it
from Mischief.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
So Mischief was this 80s movie that Chris and I both really like. It's this kind of coming of age 80s. Movie set in the 50s.
Yeah, it's like one of those like nerdy guy meets up with rebel who gets him laid kind of movies.
Yeah, so yeah. This is one of those instances where the guy, like, he's in this movie and he's like playing like this older man, like in his 50s, which I guess he is. And yeah, like one of those ones where you're just looking and you're just like, no, like no matter how long he's on screen, you just can't place him in Mischief.
Right. I didn't even think he had done anything recently.
He hasn't really. He's sort of worked fairly steadily, but it was just really weird to see him in this.
Huh.
So overall, I mean, I'd say if this is your jam, you know, watch the first two, but I think you could probably give this one a pass. I also feel like this has kind of killed the series. Like, I don't think this is going to keep going after this. If they keep trying to mix it up like this, no. They should just stick with what they know and bring Monroe back, maybe. And but how much can you do with that premise anyways?
I think it was a bad decision bringing back a character from the original movie.
Yeah, they shouldn't have.
Like, because, you know, like, I understand these are kind of exploitation movies and kind of horror movies, but you have to think of it logically in the sense that if this is a rape victim in the first movie, and then they've gone on in that movie to kill their aggressors, they're going to be pretty fucking damaged.
Oh, yeah.
So they're not going to come back in this third movie and all of a sudden be like, that's it, I'm a vigilante. It just doesn't fly for me. It sounds weird.
Well, I'm just seeing her getting all like gussied up. I'm just like, this is like so not... Like, even if you're damaged and nuts, like, it's not making any sense.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like going against almost what the movies were trying to do in the first place, if they're trying to do anything. Like, are they just exploitation movies? It was almost like, we know they're exploitation movies, but we're going to try and have a message now to justify the fact that we've been doing these movies.
Yeah, I get
it. And it just didn't work at all. So... I'd say this is the end of the series. It's certainly the end of me buying any of the series. Well,
at least you're done.
I'm done.
So for now. Now what's next?
Or do you have another one? Do you want
to have you what's your next series?
Oh, I don't know because I'm kind of torn now. Like, are we gonna do episodes on franchises or am I gonna keep doing this?
I really enjoyed the Missing in Action episode. I thought that was fun, and like I was telling you, it gave me an excuse to actually watch these movies because I'm like, oh, we're going to be talking about these. I got to watch these. You know, this gives me a opportunity to actually take some of the Blu-rays I own out of their shrink wrap.
Right.
So, I mean, I like the series episodes and hopefully people liked that Missing in Action thing. And, you know, I think we should do more series.
Yeah. So either I'll go through like a series, maybe I'll find one that you just don't care about. So yeah, like, well, this one.
Like that one, yeah, in Lake Placid.
Yeah.
Maybe you should do Anaconda series next.
No, I think I'm okay.
Okay, so I'm going to get my second negatory one out of the way.
All right.
And then I don't have anything overly negative after this.
Okay.
So I watched Arrow Video has released Nico Mastorakis' 1986 movie The Zero Boys.
Yeah.
On Blu-ray. And this is a movie I remember seeing on VHS back in the day and not really enjoying. And I got to tell you, it's still kind of stiff.
Yeah, Chris was like, oh, man, I really wanted that one. Can I have that one? Please give me that one.
My opinion, I just saw it. I was like, oh, this might be cool. Maybe I missed out on something. I didn't. So the basic premise of this movie is that it opens with this really cool scene of like this old kind of Western town and these people like sneaking around like all gussied up in military gear with these guns, like trying to hunt each other down. And we find out it's just like a big paintball tournament, kind of.
Okay.
And the main characters are these guys called the Zero Boys, who are like the big paintball champions, you know? So it's like this cool kind of like action kind of sequence at the beginning where, you know, they're shooting at people and like diving behind cars. And, you know, the main bad guy's wearing like a friggin' swastika on his arm because he's like the really bad guy who's like trying to be the Nazi and everything.
Nothing says bad like a swastika.
Exactly. You know, so it's kind of fun. It's a pretty fun opening to the movie. And then these Zero Boys, they gather up the main bad guys, like their opponent's girlfriend, played by Kelly Maroney.
Right.
She has been offered up as a prize for the guy who wins to take on a date.
Oh.
So the Zero Boys, their girlfriends, and Kelly Maroney's character head off, you know, out into the outback of California or wherever it is. And
outback of California.
Well, you know, it's like it's set in California and they're trying to make it like this like hillbilly kind of country.
Okay.
So they end up like at this, they find this shack out in the woods and they like kind of go in there and they're like, oh, we got to spend the night here. We're having the typical engine trouble kind of stuff they always have in these movies, right? And eventually, you know, they fall victim to like a redneck murderer, basically. It's like a movie that promises to be an action movie from the artwork and stuff.
Totally.
And is more of a slasher movie with like action movie elements. And my issue with Zero Boys is that I just, you know, I appreciate what Mastorakis was trying to do by mixing these two genres together. And, you know, it had your typical character. You know, it had one guy who was the Joker. He's other guy who was like, you know, the serious guy was like, oh, we shouldn't be here. You know, someone owns this house. We're going to be in trouble. And, you know, and the synth heavy score that's co-done by Hans Zimmer.
Oh, wow.
This is like the first score he ever did, and he co-did it. And Hans Zimmer, he's pretty famous for musical scores. Very synth-heavy, very cool. My favorite thing about this movie actually was the score.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, they're hanging out in this house in the middle of nowhere, and they're, you know, it's moderately paced, and, you know, they're, like, just hanging out, and eventually people, you know, there's a makeout session where the girl's making out with this guy on the bed, and she looks up and she sees this hole in the roof with this eye looking at her, and she freaks out.
Right.
So they're like, oh, somebody's here, right? And obviously, because they're trespassing, they're going to become victims. And, you know, the acting's kind of iffy. There was a cool, kind of funny part where the guy's like, scares the other guy because he goes into the shed, and the other guy jumps out and he's like, what are you doing? Why'd you do that? And he's like, it wasn't me. It was Jason. I'm like, oh, okay. So they're playing that card. They're going to like,
yeah,
be like kind of self-effacing, like wink, wink. We know this is a slasher movie going on. And, you know, there was no suspense to it. No real heft to anything going on. Like, I didn't care.
Yeah.
Like, they made they're in this isolated setting. It starts raining, you know, typical tropes that we're used to seeing in these kind of movies. And I just didn't care. I was like, there was a cool moment involving a plastic bag that I liked. And I like the fact that for the most part, Master Eka shows all the bad guys in silhouette. So there'll be like a back shot silhouette of him, and he'll like hold up his big knife. And then later in the movie, he'll hold up his crossbow, you know? And it's like, okay, so those are the bad guys, obviously. And, you know, there was no real motive behind everything. And it just had this potential that was hindered by this weak execution, you know? And there's,
dude, this sounds terrible.
It just wasn't very good. It was very uninspired. I was just, when I'm watching, I'm going, okay, whatever.
Okay. Did you watch it late?
No, not really.
Huh.
I'm just like, whatever, this is... I liked... Arrow's put out two better slasher movies. There's The Mutilator, which even okay, I was kind of like...
Mutilator, it's better.
Which I was kind of like, Mutilator, it's okay, but not great. And there's Blood Rage.
Yeah.
So, out of the trio of slasher movies, Arrow's put out Blood Rage. Still. It's all the right way to go. Pretty good special features on the disc, and I've never seen the movie look as good as it does. So, if you're a fan, by all means, pick it up. I'm not a fan, and that's all I'm saying. That's my last negative thing I watched this week.
Okay.
It's just not very inspiring. That's all I'm saying. All
right.
And I'm a big 80s slasher dude, so the idea of mixing an action movie and a slasher movie is kind of like you put your chocolate in my peanut butter.
Yeah.
But your fucking peanut butter was rancid.
Ooh, all I got Jesus, to say. Man.
Yeah.
Well, the cover is cool.
Yeah. It's got that going for it.
Yeah.
No, there's a couple of cool things. The Hans Zimmer score is...
Kelly Maroney's cool.
She's not that great in this.
No?
No, she's kind of like... I don't know. A lot of the people in this movie didn't have a point. That was my main issue.
Hmm.
The score was cool. There's a couple of cool shots. There's that cool plastic bag moment. So, you know, if you are curious about seeing an action movie mixed with a slasher movie from the 80s, then check it out for sure. But just not my jam.
Got it. All right. Well, let's talk about another Arrow release.
Okay.
While we're at it.
Why not?
So the one I watched was Eaten Alive from 1976, directed by Tobe Hooper. So this was Hooper's follow-up to Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and which I think Chris and I kind of agree on is probably one of the best horror movies ever made.
Texas Chainsaw and Halloween are my two favorite horror movies of all time.
So... this one was weird. So I've seen this before.
Yeah.
And I know when this was out on VHS that it was at least seems to be. And I know my experience with it is it was very dark and hard to see anything. I remember just not being able to see a lot of the action. And I remember Neville Brand, who's like the lead guy in this, being really annoying. And I just remember
Robert Englund being really skeevy.
Yeah, and I remember lighting being kind of like comic booky, like it kind of like felt like Scooby Doo or like Creepshow or something,
right?
Like or Suspiria even, but I'm not gonna definitely not comparing this to Suspiria, but just with those really you know bright like red lights and stuff like that. So that's what I remember. So now I had this nice Arrow Blu-ray of it, and it's all cleaned up, and you can see everything and. Yeah, so it opens up with Robert Englund, who plays, who we all know as Freddy Krueger, unbuttoning his pants. It's like a shot of his crotch, and he said, "My name's Buck, and I'm raring to fuck." And then he...
So it's kind of like Kill Bill. Maybe that's where Tarantino got it from.
Is that a line in Kill Bill?
Yeah.
Oh, it must be where the line's from.
Well, I'm not sure if it's the name is Buck, but it's one of the male nurses at the hospital in Kill Bill 1.
Yeah, I think that's Michael, what's his name, the guy from Valley Girl.
Yeah, I can't remember his name either, but yeah, there's a very similar line in Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah. Anyway, so then this is the opening scene. Immediately we have Roberta Collins in the scene, which I'm like, oh, Roberta Collins is in this. And I love Roberta Collins. If I've talked to Roberta before, she's one of my favorite 70s exploitation actresses. She was in Big Dollhouse and Unholy Roller. She's been in lots of really cool movies, so I really like her. And I'm like, oh shit, I didn't even realize she was in this. And so she's playing a prostitute who's with Robert Englund, and then Robert Englund then proceeds to like decide he wants to have sex with her up the bum. So I'm like, what the fuck? Like, this is, you know, what? Like, I don't remember this at all. And I'm like, this is bizarre.
Well, when you were a kid and you saw this on VHS, you had no idea what anal sex was, Josh.
Well, no, I didn't. And I'm like, what the? Like, this doesn't even feel like Toby Hooper. Like, he's not like this. Like, what's going on? And then, like, the whole movie kind of has this, like, weird tone of, like, kind of sleazy and it's just off. The whole movie's off. So Robert Englund's like chasing Roberta Collins around, and then so she like escapes the like bordello where she works and goes off and finds this hotel in the middle of the swamp, kind of like Motel Hell. And its proprietor is played by Neville Brand, who's playing this crazy guy named Judd, and he pretty much kills everyone that comes to the hotel with a scythe and then throws them in the pool in the backyard that has his pet alligator in it.
How can he get word of mouth for his hotel if everyone who comes there dies?
I don't know.
People can't be like, man, I stayed at this wicked hotel. You should go check it out.
And everyone knows he's nuts. And he like mumbles to himself like throughout the movie. So I was like, and he's like, looks like he's drunk throughout, which I think he might have actually been.
Okay.
Neville Brand.
So it's like watching a John Carradine movie too.
Yeah, it was weird. And so that part's still annoying. But I did think it was pretty entertaining, especially when I think about it.
On a bizarre level?
It's really weird, man. Like it's not boring. Like you're never bored. But you're kind of like, what the fuck's going on? Like through the whole movie, but not like confusing. It's just more like, what the hell? Like there's this, the next group that shows up at the hotel is Marilyn Burns from Texas Chainsaw in a wig. And she's with William Finley from Phantom of the Paradise, who's, you know, he's being a little off. But anyway, and then they're with their daughter played by Kyle Richards, who's Kim Richards' little sister, and they have a little dog. So like they arrive at the hotel, they meet up with Judd, then they're like looking around on the back deck and there's like a dead monkey in a cage. So the little girl's like all freaking out about this weird dead monkey, but not really freaking out. She's just kind of like, there's a dead monkey in the cage. And then meanwhile the little dog is like scratching at the like fence to like where the alligator lives, and the alligator comes and eats the dog. And you're just like, what the fuck? So then the girl starts screaming, and then they all go up to their room, and like Marilyn Burns is trying to calm the little girl down. Meanwhile, William Finley, the husband, just starts acting like fucking bizarre. Like he like does like these weird like hand movements, and he like does this like weird like screaming thing like Donald Sutherland in like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And then he like starts barking like a dog. Like it's just totally out there. It's like fucking Crispin Glover is all of a sudden in the room. And then Marilyn Burns then takes off her wig, and she's got her regular Marilyn Burns hair, and you're like, what the hell? Like it's just all really weird, right?
Why is she wearing a wig in the first place?
I don't know, right? It's just all really weird. And then like next, you know, so this all happens, and then later on Mel Ferrer shows up with his daughter. Turns out he's Roberta Collins' father as well, and they're on the search for Roberta Collins. And then you know, at one point, like, the daughter then starts trying to hook up with the sheriff, who's played by Stuart Whitman from Shatter, but he's, like, way older than her, and it's totally out of place again. Then she, like, has this nude scene that's, like, completely unnecessary. She goes into her room, takes her top off, walks to a closet with her top off, walks back, and then puts her top back on. It doesn't make any sense.
She's like, oh.
Like, it's just like, oh, we need a nude scene, and this is what we're going to do.
I think I'll change my top. You know what? I changed my mind.
Yeah, it's just weird. We've also got Carolyn Jones from Adam's Family, like Morticia, but, like, you can't even tell it's her. She's buried under, like, probably, I'd say, an inch of makeup.
Huh.
It's so weird. And then... we've also got Janice Blythe, who played Ruby in Hills Have Eyes, like one of the, like, redneck people. And she, like, plays this, like, kind of slutty girl that's all over Robert Englund. And again, she has a nude scene, but it's just, again, just really kind of awkward. So the whole thing is just quite awkward and, but quite fascinating at the same time. So, I'd actually kind of recommend this just because it's so weird. But it feels like the movie Hooper would have made before Texas Chainsaw when he was trying to, like, figure out how to make,
like,
a movie.
It's like a step backwards.
It is, but then it's like, but was he doing this intentionally? Like, was he trying to be really weird?
Or was it producer interruption?
Well, I heard there was producer meddling. So I heard Hooper didn't actually direct the whole movie. Also, so, like, I know Neville Brand was apparently a real difficult person to work with. And, man, like, Roberta Collins tells a story in one of the DVD features, and you're just like, holy shit, like, this guy is nuts. Like, a story about real life with him. And, yeah, it's just a, it's something else. It's like, I haven't seen anything like this movie, but it's certainly not, like, just the, like, crazy guy with the alligator movie. It looks like it's like really out there, like, it really so it's very interesting from that perspective, but not a lot of fun to watch, but definitely fun to talk about and think about afterwards.
Yeah, I know. I have the before Arrow put it out, Dark Sky put out a DVD of it.
Yeah,
and I know I have the... They had two releases of... They had one release that was intended to go out, and then they recalled it, and I can't recall... I don't know why. That's the version I have.
Oh, okay.
And then they put out another... I think they had some rights issues or something where they had to remove a special feature.
Oh, okay.
So what's on the Arrow disc then? Like, is it all
new? It's got a commentary.
Is it all new stuff?
It's got a bunch of older interviews.
Right.
And then it's got an older Hooper interview, and it's got a newer Hooper interview. I know it's got an interview with Roberta Collins. It's got an interview with Janice Blythe. The interviews are actually quite good, but I liked the older ones better than the newer ones. Like, I think Marilyn Burns is an older one. But so it's got a bunch of these interviews and a commentary. But this whole movie's based on a true story about this guy named Roy Ball or Alan Ball. I can't remember what the killer's name is, but it's based on an actual killer. So there's a little featurette on that guy as well.
Huh.
But it's worth... I would never recommend watching this on, like, VHS or something, but if you can get the Arrow DVD, it's worth a look. It just has a curiosity, but it's definitely an oddball flick. But it's got enough about it that it's going to be... I think I'll remember it now.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot more.
Cool.
It's not really a ringing endorsement.
Well... It sounds like it's one of those movies where the story behind the making of it is a lot more interesting than the actual movie itself.
Just for the William Finley stuff, like, he's only in it for like 10 minutes, but it's whack. And then Robert Englund is pretty great.
And he made
this
after Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah. Well, I just couldn't believe how many name actors were in this thing. And it was all shot on a studio too. Like, nothing was shot on location. All of this was in a soundstage.
So they had, like, they made this shack in the swamp on a soundstage?
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Okay, well, it's not a ringing endorsement, but it's...
I'd say check it out, though.
It's a curiosity for you 70s low-budget fans out there.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's go back to the 50s for my next one.
The '50s.
Yeah.
Oh.
I watched The Ghost of Drag Strip Hollow.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it was on AMC or wow. Not AMC, TCM, and it's an AIP American International Pictures production. It's apparently a sequel, which I didn't know, to the Hot Rod Gang.
Oh, and, okay, I didn't know that either.
And it's all it is AIP cashing in on teen hot rod culture at the time. You know, it's like the late 50s. You know, it opens up with like this hot rod race through, you know how in Los Angeles area they have those like, they did it in Greece too. They had a car race through it where it's like these big kind of, they're kind of like a sewer canal in a way. They're just like they got the long the sides on them and they like, what are they? Water mains or
waterways?
Waterways.
I think that's what they're called.
Okay. Well, they're having this race at the beginning and it's these two girls and they like, you know, there's a crash up in cops and you know, it turns out that, it's sped up, of course, because they do that a lot in these movies. They speed up the action to make it, you know, more humorous. And, you know, it's just basically about these guys, this batch of hot rodders who are, you know, have their little clubhouse and, you know, they always, like, we're not bad kids. We just like to hot rod. We work on our cars and everything. And there's this adult reporter who's there to try and, like, you know, learn about their culture and, like, show people that, you know, these hot rodders aren't so bad after all.
Right.
You know, and, you know, there's the nerdy dude, the jokester in the hat. You know, they've got all the hip terms from the 50s. Like, they call each other daddy-o and stuff like that. And they kind of hang out at this rock and sock hop where there's this this band playing all the time. And there's one song where the band's, like, the band leader's singing and he... In between his verses, he's like taking out a pistol and shooting it in the air. And when he's doing that, all dancing people stomp and everything. So it's like this weird moment like that.
Nice.
And these moments are scattered throughout this movie. It's like a 65-minute movie, but it's fucking weird.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's they find out that they're going to lose their clubhouse. Their aunt comes down who's got this pet parrot who cracks jokes the entire movie.
Oh, yeah, the parrot.
So it's like, you know, he's talking about like, oh, you know, don't make jokes about crackers. The parrot gets pissed off when people say, do you want a cracker to it? And it's always like making jokes. And, you know, the parents don't understand the kids. You know, the kids are having like a slumber party. The parents are like, what are they still doing up? It's a slumber party. They should be slumbering, you know, all this kind of 50s stuff like that. Right. And it's totally formulaic, you know, mild humor. The aunt's rich. So she's like, oh, I can help you. We can go to this house that I know that I own. But the problem is it's haunted. So
okay.
If you guys can stay in this house, you know, overnight or whatever, we can figure out why it's haunted. You guys can use it as your hot rod clubhouse, right? So, like, it's called The Ghost of Drag Strip Hollow, but there's really not any ghosts in this.
Oh.
Like, you know, for the first two-thirds of the movie, it's just them hanging out, cracking lame jokes, you know, dancing different songs. Because at the time, American International had a record label. So
okay.
So they were like... putting artists on their record label in this movie and like dance sequences just to try and sell their records kind of, you know, and it's kind of okay.
Like, it sounds like I dig this
like
movie.
In the last half, there's like, you know, there's this part in the slumber party where they're doing like this pajama dance-a-thon and you're like, okay, I've seen movies with slumber parties. Once the killer burst in and killed them, like, you know, it doesn't happen in this movie. Instead, they're just dancing around and then, they're playing this song, which is like kind of like cowboy, and they turn on the TV and there's this show where it's just like cowboys and wagons, like wagon trains, just like flipping over and everything. And the girls are just sitting there laughing their asses off at the TV before they start dancing again. It's just like so random. A lot of the stuff in this movie is just so random, right? And, you know, the parents, they sleep in separate beds because this is the 50s and, you know, it's just so harmless.
Is
you know,
there monsters in this movie?
There's a monster in it who looks pretty cool. He's kind of scaly in that, but it turns out it's not a monster. Spoiler. But there's a ghost in it too, sort of. But it's just kind of one of those movies where you watch it and you're like, it's 65 minutes. You know, it breezes by. It's kind of like a time capsule of what was going on in teen culture. Yeah. And, you know, it's just kind of fun. It's just like goofy. Like, there's nothing to it. It's pretty slight, but there's all these weird dance sequences and, you know, jokes and everything. And
I don't know why I know this, But I think there's a couple of famous monsters make cameos in this.
Not that I
Does that know. Ring any bells?
It could be during there's a costume party at the end where people might have been dressed up like them.
Okay.
But that's all I really, like, I don't remember actually seeing them and being like, oh, wait, that's that guy or whatever, okay. Right? Huh. But I like how it's pretty much plotless, but at the end, the title card says, The Endist Man. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. It's so hip. But what I found interesting about it was that it's written by Lou Russoff. And this is the guy who wrote Beach Party, the original Beach Party movie, like 4 years later.
Right.
And this movie is a total template for Beach Party.
Like the Frankie Avalon thing?
Yeah, like okay. The Frankie Avalon and Ned Funicello. It's the exact same plot as Beach Party, but it's 4 years prior. It felt like kind of like Hot Rod Culture meets Scooby-Doo.
Okay.
So it was kind of fun.
Sounds fun.
I kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd check that out.
Yeah, if you like goofy, like, 50s movies that don't take themselves too seriously, check out Ghost from...
Oh, but was it in color or black and white?
Black and white.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh.
Well, there goes half our listeners.
Ah, well. Ghost of Dragster Apollo was fun.
Right on.
It's available on a double feature DVD from, remember those MGM Midnight movies?
Yeah, I have it.
It's Ghost of Dragster Apollo and Ghost in the Invisible Bikini.
Yeah, yeah.
So, double win. Right double on. Win. Okay.
What Invisible did you got? Bikini.
Invisible bikinis.
Huh. How many more do you have?
I got one more.
Okay. Okay, so the next one I'm going to talk about is a movie called Wild Card from 2015.
Jason Statham?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I've been kind of eyeing this for a while just because I don't mind the Staith.
Staith? It sounds like a friggin' staph infection. It's like, I got the Staith.
Yeah. So I don't mind.
Kind of get me a shot.
I don't mind the Staith. It's directed by Simon West, who did Con Air, which I also don't mind.
Put the bunny back in the box.
And he also directed Tomb Raider, the first Tomb Raider.
Didn't he?
He's done some other stuff.
Did he do Expendables 2?
Yeah, he did Expendables 2. Okay. So he's all right. Okay, so this was also written by William Goldman, who is a very, 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 very famous screenwriter.
Isn't Wild Card a remake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. Do you know what it's a remake of?
I can't remember.
All right, we'll get to that. So William Goldman has written movies like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yep.
And All the President's Men.
Hell yeah.
And Marathon Man. And Stepford Wives. And yeah. Wild Card. So it doesn't really feel...
That's a resume there.
Like a William Goldman movie.
I know. You're like, all these good movies in Wild Card.
So yeah, like this guy wrote a book called, I think it was called Adventures in the Screen Trade. Like it's kind of like a Bible for screenwriters, yeah. Right? So like, it's kind of weird that this thing just showed up on Netflix. And like, how did this even get made? So turns out it looks like this was kind of a pet project of the Staith. He really wanted to make this movie. So I think Goldman wrote the script a long time ago. It was made in the 80s with, it always comes back to him, with Burt.
Oh, yeah.
A movie called Heat.
So okay, yeah.
This is a remake of Heat from the 80s. And Goldman wrote a novel called Heat, and he wrote the screenplay for this Burt movie.
I saw Heat like 3-4 months ago.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, you never talked about it.
That's because I didn't like it.
Talked about Malone.
I didn't like Heat that much. Oh. So I didn't want to talk about it.
So this is a remake.
Okay.
And I kind of looked into it. I don't remember Heat at all. But after seeing this, I went and read
the... Yeah, it's set in like casinos.
Yeah, I read the synopsis for Heat, and it is quite identical. So the Staith stars as Nick Wilde, and he's like this really badass kind of like a bodyguard. He's an ex-soldier fortune that's now a bodyguard in Vegas.
I get what they did there.
What?
His name's Nick Wilde, and the movie's called Wild Card.
Exactly.
I get what they did.
Exactly.
Very witty.
So the Staith's just sort of going around, and he's like being really badass, and he is a badass. Like this, he's... Like, not a mean badass, but he's just one of those guys where you just know he's super tough and super cool.
I could kind of take or leave him.
He's really good in this one.
Okay.
Probably the best I've ever seen him.
Okay.
I like him, but all his movies kind of blend together for me.
They totally do.
And this one's more almost like a drama than an action movie. So, yeah, he actually has to act a little more. It's not just him running around doing transporter stuff. But all the... Yeah, and it does sort of stand apart because there's not a lot of action, but the action in it is quite good. So it turns out this girl he it doesn't really establish what their relationship was, but anyway, this girl he knows gets shit kicked by this. Can't decide if she was a hooker or not, but anyway, she goes up to
I'll just interrupt you for a second, sorry. Yeah. In Heat, she was a hooker. Okay. She was a prostitute, and it was a mob boss's son who shit-kicked her in Heat. Yeah. Yeah,
so she's brought up to this... She goes up to this hotel room and basically gets the shit kicked out of her by this guy. Anyway, so she goes to Nick Wilde and for help. And then he says, okay, I'll find out who did it. So she tracks it down. It was this mob boss's son guy. And then the two of them go up to the room where he lives or where he's staying. And they let her get revenge on the mob boss's son guy. Now, this guy is played by Milo Ventimiglia. Do you know that name?
Yeah, I've seen him.
He was on
stuff.
Heroes. Now, I don't know a lot about this guy, but he popped up in Gotham last season, and he's fucking good, man. This guy's really.
I have a feeling he was in one of those remakes recently too, like Nightmare on Elm Street or something.
Maybe he's really good looking and he's really menacing. Like he's one of these guys. He just has a real presence. So I thought he was great in this movie, and anyway, she. Injures him a little bit, and then he's kind of left humiliated, and then they steal some money from him and off they go. Anyway, one thing leads to another. Nick Wilde eventually gets framed for murder, and the mob boss is after him. I'm not going to give away the end, but it's a really good little movie. Clips along really well. I do want to see the Burt version now because I'm curious, but this was just a fun little movie. I thought the Staith acted quite well in it, and there's a lot of really great cameos. We've got like Hope Davis, Stanley Tucci, Jason Alexander pops up, Sofia Vergara. The action sequences were done by Corey Yoon, who's does action in a lot of great movies and also works with Jason Statham quite a bit. Brian De Palma was originally attached to this movie. He stepped away, and that's how they ended up getting Simon West. So what I was saying earlier is I think the Staith really wanted to make this movie, and that's how it happened. He got it done. It's also set in Vegas, and they use actual casino names, and like when they're like the villain is staying in the Golden Nugget, and they're talking about the Golden Nugget. I thought that was pretty neat. Anyway, I like movies set in Vegas, and I like kind of badass dudes, and there's just not enough of them anymore, and it's a fun little flick. I'd recommend checking it out if you see it on Netflix, but I don't know. Apparently Heat is not as good, so.
I didn't think Heat was as good.
Yeah, was this very was good. It was kind of neat finding out after the fact that it was a remake, because then I wasn't, like, wondering the whole time.
That's true.
Yeah, so it was kind of neat, because I just thought it was a new movie, and it turns out it's a total remake, so, yeah.
I wonder if Jason Statham, after he's had his way with a lady, is like, you just got the state infection.
I really hope not.
That
was really weird, dude. Was like something that would be said and eaten alive.
Well, you know, I got to keep this train rolling. So... Speaking of action movies, I watched this. I decided to hit the Dollarama pile.
Oh no! Oh, I know why this is.
So I watched a movie that Josh also owns, but he bought from the Walmart $5 bin. It's a movie called Exit Speed from 2008.
Yeah,
and it's you know, it's one of those movies that promises a lot from the box art. Because, you know, it's got, like, these semi-well-known names. You know, it's got Desmond Harrington, Fred Ward, Leah Thompson.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got their faces above this bus. And this bus is surrounded by this biker gang. Yeah. So you're like, oh, it shit.
Sounds so awesome.
I'm like, this is like Speed, man, only with bikers, right? So it is kind of. basic gist of this movie is it opens with Fred Ward busting into the hotel room of this... this girl played by Julie Mond called Corporal Cole, who has, you know, deserted from the army, and Fred Ward's a military cop trying to track her down. So this kind of establishes their relationship and just gives us a chance to meet the Fred Ward character, because he does kind of pop up throughout this movie off and on as he's hunting down this girl. So she kind of ends up running away and ends up on a bus, like a Greyhound kind of bus. So, you know, it's your typical thing where a movie like this establishes its characters early on by having them all riding this bus to El Paso, Texas.
Right.
It's Christmas Eve. They're all kind of going back home or, you know, doing what they have to do. You know, there's your typical, there's your Leah Thompson playing like your older lady who's trying to get home to her kids.
Aww.
You got Desmond Harrington playing like this kind of like guy who's estranged from his family who's trying to go mend fences with them.
How did you feel watching Leah Thompson as an older lady?
Whatever.
Like, was she an old lady?
Well, she's... What do you mean, old lady?
Well, he said older lady. I'm picturing, like, a grandmother.
She's like a cougar.
Okay.
So she doesn't look, like, a heck of a lot different than she used to, only a little bit more, like, you know, liney around the edges, I guess you'd call it. A little bit wrinkly here and there. But she doesn't look a heck of a lot different, but I kind of still question myself having a crush on her in the 80s. So, you know, we've talked about this before, Josh. Why you always have to bring this up? Leah Thompson is not the reason I watched this movie.
I saw Leah Thompson recently on a Tales from the Crypt episode.
Did you?
Yeah, and it's the one where she gets old. So maybe that's why I'm kind of high up on it.
It could be. It could be. So it establishes, you know, these people on this bus going home. And while they're driving to El Paso, they kind of get... You know, the bus driver kind of has to deal with this biker gang, like, zooming at them. And, like, he has to swerve around them. And they're like, oh, fucking bikers, kind of like that, right? But these bikers just like to harass people. And the bus driver ends up, like, running over one of their members.
Oh.
And you don't do that with a bike gang, obviously, right?
Yeah.
Especially when the bike gang's a bunch of meth heads.
Oh, great.
So really, that it goes into action when he hits this biker, kills him. Gets the bike gang after him, and you're like, okay, this is going to be sweet. This is going to be like a chase movie. You know, they're going to be on this bus. The biker's going to be harassing him. Not quite. Really, this movie has a bus chase at in the first 20 minutes and then becomes a siege movie.
Oh.
Because they end up crashing at this scrapyard.
Right.
And when they're at the scrapyard, they have to kind of like barricade themselves in and try and fight their way out. So the whole majority of the movie is them trying to defend themselves and fight their way out of this junkyard.
I like junkyard movies.
While they're surrounded by this biker gang.
Is there a car crusher?
The car crusher does not come to play in this movie. Sorry, Josh. But
why would you do a movie? Why would you do a movie in a junkyard and not use the car crusher?
It's more like
a
scrapyard than an actual big junkyard. It's like one of those.
Why would you make a movie like this and know that you could make a movie in a car yard with a car crusher and choose to do it in a scrapyard?
Maybe they didn't have the budget for a car crusher.
Well,
who knows, man?
Car crushers are maybe so you fucking cool.
Maybe you should have talked to the writer and said, dude, car crusher.
Haven't you seen Mondo Kane? Go watch that shit. It's car crusher.
Dude, car crusher. But, you know,
you seen Goldfinger, man? Fuck. Car crusher. So, I think Goldfinger got me going on the car crushers, by the way.
So Exit Speed, not quite what I was expecting. You know, I was expecting a chase movie and I got a siege movie.
Right.
But that's okay. You know, they don't really establish the bad guys. They're just kind of like these faceless, drug-using motorbike guys.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with that because the script actually does attempt to have some character development with like Leah Thompson's character, Desmond Harrington's character, Julie Mon's character. And, you know, Julie Mon being a military expert, she kind of guides them to like survival. And at the same time, Fred Ward is kind of on the outskirts of the picture, kind of getting closer to where they are. And I love Fred Ward, dude. Like Tremors, Remo Williams. I love this dude. Doesn't matter what he's in. He's good in this too. He's only in it for about 10 minutes total. But he's really good in it, I gotta
say. Who's the villain?
Like I said, they're faceless.
There's no, like, lead villain or
anything?
There's
no lead villain. It's just, like, a bunch of dudes on motorbikes wearing, like, kind of, like, weird, like, military helmets. And, like, the one guy looks kind of like Meatloaf riding his motorbike because he's got, like, this flow. He's, like, overweight and he's got this flowing fucking coat with this red scarf around his neck.
Really?
And I'm like, holy fuck, Meatloaf's is the guy in this biker gang, right? And you know, it's just like there was this girl in it, I can't remember the actress's name here at the moment, But it's like the street smart black girl, right? So she's kind of sassy, and you know, she kind of gets pissed off at her boyfriend because he's a coward, but she's also like kind of rallying the troops too. And I really liked her in it. Desmond Harrington, I recognized from Dexter. He had a pretty big role in Dexter as one of the detectives. He was also in this really, really cool 2003 horror movie called Love Object. As the lead in that, where he's like this guy who like gets a love doll and basically becomes obsessed with it, and like it leads to mayhem. And you know, the action scenes are pretty efficient. It was directed by a guy called Scott Zeal, who did check this out, dude. He directed Roadhouse 2.
Oh, Roadhouse 2.
He directed Cruel Intentions 3.
Oh.
And he directed the remake of Earth vs. the Spider.
Wow, so, that's quite the resume.
You know, he knows how to make...
Hey, Roadhouse 2 wasn't bad. I didn't mind it.
He knows how to make low-budget action, is what I'm trying to say here. So, you know, the finale has got, like, you know, arrow shooting, shotgun blasting, blood squibs, you know, stuff exploding, you know. It's got this guy who's like just, he's a Spanish dude, like a Mexican dude, and he's like a handyman, and he makes this thing that, like, you know those t-shirt cannons that you see at sporting events? Fuck. It's kind of like one of those, only it shoots fucking missiles. It's kind of sweet, dude.
Okay.
So he shoots this off, you know, it's got Molotovs. It's kind of like, you know, I liked it.
I'd like this. I liked
the characters, and I liked the action. I thought the action was pretty good for a low budget action movie. And when I was looking into it, I thought it was funny that the writer is Michael Stokes. He's written a lot of stuff like that we saw in the 90s as like Canadian action movie fans. Because he did Jungle Ground. He wrote Jungle Ground with Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Yeah.
Which was like the Escape from New York ripoff.
Yeah.
He wrote Iron Eagle 4.
You're on your own there, bud.
So, and he wrote No Contest 2.
Oh, the beauty pageant
one. Yeah, the beauty pageant one. Yeah. So this guy, he's written some, yeah, you know, not, it's kind
we
of
both
sus.
Know our Shannon Tweed movies.
Yeah, if you, yeah. He's written some suspect 90s movies, okay? But Exit Speed, you know, after I've been beaten down so much by these Dollarama movies, that when one comes along that's actually pretty good, that's entertaining, it kind of is like exciting for me. So
I have another Dollarama biker movie called Poker Run.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so stay tuned, everyone. Yeah. Make sure you keep tuning in.
So Exit Speed, if you're into like low-budget kind of movies, like the kind of stuff you'd watch with like Jeff Wincott or Donna Dragon Wilson and stuff like that, only with a little bit more characterization to it and personality, Exit Speed's pretty cool, man.
Right on. No,
it's a pretty fun movie.
It does look fun. We both picked it up. Yeah. Obviously, I thought it looked good. So.
It's a pretty fun movie.
Right on. All right. Well...
That's my last one, by the way.
I got to talk about Grindhouse releasing, because I picked up Cannibal Ferox from them.
Okay.
And holy shit, man, these guys do a good job. I just got to say, because, you know, I'm always going on about Arrow and Scream Factory and stuff, but man, this is like a fucking awesome edition of this movie. So, that's what I'm going to talk about, Cannibal Ferox. So this is Umberto Lenzi, infamous cannibal movie. It's probably one of the more famous of the cannibal cycle of the late 70s, yeah,
probably after,
70s and 80s.
Probably after...
after Cannibal Holocaust. I'd say this is the second one. So it's a different vibe than Cannibal Holocaust. I mean, Cannibal Holocaust is found footage and pretty serious. This one is a little more campy. But still, I think I might like this one a little better. I think Cannibal Holocaust is a better movie, but this one's a little more rewatchable. It still has some of the nastiness of the genre that has kind of brought it down a bit, and I'm talking about animal violence. This one certainly has some of that. We've got a kind of like a rodent, like an anteater type thing getting killed by a snake. And we've got a pig getting killed and a turtle being killed and a caiman being killed. among other things. So, you know, those scenes are pretty bad, but I didn't find they were as dwelly as Cannibal Holocaust was. They were in this movie, but I just didn't find that they were kind of the focus of the movie like in the other one. Okay, I'm going to stop comparing it to Cannibal Holocaust. So let's talk about it on its own. So this one opens up in New York with an awesome opening theme song by Roberto Donati. And actually, the whole score for this movie is really good. So I just wanted to give a shout out to him because this is one of the better Italian scores other than Goblin that I know about. So it opens up in New York with this groovy song, and we're going through the streets of New York following this dude, and it's really great because it's like so Times Square of the like grungy era. So we're getting all these great New York shots. Anyway, this dude ends up at this apartment, and he ends up getting killed by these two thugs. And then we're next thing you know, we're in the Amazon following, it's really weird, following this trio of young people. We've got a girl and her friend and her brother. And the girl is played by Lorraine Dessel. She's in House on the Edge of the Park and in some other movies. And she's like a grad student out to prove that cannibals don't exist. So she's going to prove the cannibals don't exist. So she goes to the Amazon to try and find a cannibal tribe to prove that cannibals don't exist. So it's kind of, you know, a typical Italian movie of this time period. Like, what, you know, it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And so off they go into the Amazon and, you know, their car breaks down. And, you know, instead of walking back to the city, nope, they're just going to go move forward and see what's up. And then they come across like a couple of cannibals that have been obviously beaten or been killed, one by like a booby trap, and the other one, I can't remember what was up with them, but anyway, it's these two dead dudes. And you know, now they're still going to keep moving forward, they're not going to go back, they're still going to keep checking out what's up going on. So eventually they run into they find a empty camp of where cannibals lived. And there's still a group of cannibals at the camp. Well, they're natives at this point. They're not cannibals. But they find this group of these elders at the camp. And they're just sort of sitting there, and they're not saying anything, and they're not doing anything. So the group just sort of decides to hang out at this camp with the elder natives sort of hanging out outside the different structures. They also run into a drug addict. He's played by Giovanni Lamberto Radice. He's quite a famous actor from these movies. He was in he's the guy that got the drill through the head in Great Gates of Hell or City of the Living Dead, and he's been in a bunch of other movies. And he's like this kind of guy that's kind of like a drug dealer type thug guy, and he's with his friend that's injured. Anyway, they stay at this camp, and the young cannibals are away, and they're hanging out with the elders. And eventually we find out that the guy, the character of Mike, the Giovanni Lamberto Radice character, went crazy and killed one of the cannibals. So they're like, shit, we got to get out of here before the young cannibals get back or we're fucked. Anyway, the young cannibals get back, and then mayhem ensues. And we just get treated to all kinds of violence and carnage. We get castrations. We get arms, hands chopped off. We get eviscerations. We get a piranha attack. We get a girl hung up with hooks through her boobs. So it's a lot of really gory stuff. And but, I mean, that's kind of what you're signing up for with a movie like this. And it's pretty fun. And watching this on in widescreen on this super awesome cleaned up print is quite something. I mean, I first saw Cannibal Ferox on a busty old VHS that you can hardly see, and then I saw it again on the Grindhouse DVD, which was non-anamorphic and still a little dirty, and now it's this cleaned up awesome print, and it's something else. And this, what an entertaining movie. And you know, this movie is so packed with features, and just hearing all the stories about this movie, and like Radice is hilarious. I'd love to like actually interview this guy one day, because he like doesn't hold back. He like calls this movie shit, and like repeatedly calls Umberto Lenzi an asshole, and like he's pretty fucking funny. And just, you know, I just blows my mind that these guys actually went to the Amazon in this time period and like made a movie like this with actual natives. And it actually gives me a little bit more respect for Eli Roth for trying to emulate this. I know you're down on Green Inferno, but I think it's pretty awesome that Eli Roth did what he did and tried to emulate like what movies, like where movies like this were coming from, because this is the real deal, man. Like these guys, like it's crazy, the behind the scenes shit on this movie. And I think this movie is super entertaining, and I mean, I could do without the animal violence, but just as far as everything else goes, I mean, it's super, super gory. I mean, you can't, but it's kind of, it's just so ridiculous. Like you're not, I'm not disturbed like I am in like the I Spit on Your Grave movies or like Serbian film or something like that. It's not disturbing like that. I mean, it would be, I think, to like your average, like I think if I brought this to work and threw it on TV at lunch, yeah, it would elicit a response.
I think if you brought this to work, you wouldn't be working there anymore.
I think so, but I think to like a horror fan who's seen a lot of gore, I mean, it's not that. I mean, it's got its moments, but it's not that bad. Right?
I've actually never seen it.
Yeah, it's something else, and I just want to talk about Grindhouse's release, because this is like really good. They also put like, there's a full-length documentary on there called Eaten Alive, The Rise and Fall of the Cannibal Film. Like it's a feature-length documentary talking to all these guys about, and it goes through every cannibal movie from that time period and like reviews them and like shows scenes from them, and it's got interviews with the actors and directors. It's crazy. And like there's other features on here as well, like it's, and the whole soundtrack CD comes with it.
Well, no, that's why I'm like so tempted to just bite the bullet and pick up their release of Pieces.
Oh, dude, you
just
should.
Because it's got that 42nd Street documentary on it.
Yeah.
The full-length one. And, yeah.
They do such a good job.
They do good work.
Yeah, and I don't know. I've heard rumors that Grindhouse isn't going to be around forever. I'm really hoping those are rumors and untrue. But, you know, because Grindhouse was started by Bob Murawski and Sage Stallone, and Sage Stallone sadly passed away a few years ago, and my understanding is that Murawski was going to commit to all the movies that they said they were going to release, and then that's it. But I'm hoping he'll reconsider that, and I'm hoping that's just like hearsay. But if this is any indication of the quality of stuff they're putting out, it's wow. Like I was just so impressed with the whole package.
Yeah,
it was really great.
I've heard the exact same thing about Pieces.
Yeah, so if anyone's on the fence on Cannibal Ferox and you're a fan of the movie or you're a fan of cannibal movies, don't hesitate to pick this one up. It's worth every penny. And I'd recommend this if you're curious about the subgenre. This is one of the best ones out there. And it's just, like I said, it's a little bit more campy than Cannibal Holocaust, which is a pretty serious, depressing movie. This one's just a little more, it's just not quite as heavy, but it's still got some pretty great gore moments, and it's got all the stuff you'd expect from an exploitation film. I mean, there's some pretty offensive shit in here, so if you're offended easily, I would definitely not watch this. But I think people that are getting into movies like this know what they're getting into for the most part.
From what you're saying about it, it sounds like this is the one that was more inspired to Eli Roth than Holocaust Green Inferno.
Watching it again, it's like, holy shit. Like there's so much stuff in this that I see in Green Inferno now. But I liked Green Inferno, right? I mean, I didn't love it. And like I said when we were talking about Green Inferno, I mean, these movies aren't great. That's why I'm kind of like, well, Green Inferno is not great either.
Well, see, but I explained to you my issue with Green Inferno was that the cannibal stuff wasn't that bad. It was all the frat boy humor and shit that took me out of that movie.
Yeah. And there's still some, you know, but even in a movie like this, there's still some, you know, like, I don't know. There's still some stuff like you're always going to be able to find some stuff like that. We know you don't like Green Inferno. We don't need to get into
that whole thing again.
But I certainly see where Eli Roth.
No, just you describing it, I can kind of see the this was more of an inspiration than the Holocaust probably was.
Oh, yeah. Well, because, I mean, the Radice character is, like, tied up to, like, a, you know, in Green Inferno, that guy's tied up to that, like tree or whatever.
Yeah.
This guy is tied up to a tree for most of the movie. And, yeah, like, I mean, there's a lot of things I see like that in this. But I think this is a better movie, like a more fun movie. But I definitely get what Roth was going for, and yeah, definitely a huge inspiration was this one. But it's pretty awesome, and that documentary is really good too. Like, I mean, they interview Mimi Lay, who was in she was in Umberto Lenzi's other cannibal movie, Eaten Alive. She was also in Man from Deep River, which is I think that was Lenzi as well, actually. But she's been in a number of cannibal movies, and you know, she's reflecting back on how hard it was to shoot them and all that stuff. And then a lot of interviews with Radice and Lenzi and Diodato and stuff. So really interesting stuff. So yeah, definitely if you're a fan of the genre, absolutely pick up this release from Grindhouse.
And I know that Eaten Alive is actually coming out on Blu from Severin.
I saw that. Severin's got a whole bunch of wicked shit coming out this year.
So, you know, the more cannibal goodness for you.
I have the Shriek Show DVD, but I was mortified to find out that, like, when I picked this one.
Is that one of the ones that was framed incorrectly?
I don't think it was framed. No, that's not one of the ones that was framed incorrectly. But when I bought Cannibal Ferox now, I'm like, oh, I'm replacing my DVD. Shitty, right? My DVD is non-anamorphic. Like, I couldn't believe that I even, like, that's, like, I've just never seen this movie like this, you know? Like, yeah. I've got this DVD that's kind of shitty, and, like, so probably it's going to be a treat to get all these, like, in Blu, which is, I don't know what I'm saying.
Man, we really are in, like, a golden age for being cult niche kind of horror collectors, aren't we?
I couldn't believe that I was, like, watching Cannibal Ferox on my, like, 50-inch TV, like, looking amazing, and then I like was like driving in my car listening to the soundtrack, you know, like,
nice.
Like, who knew? Like, I never would have thought that 20 years ago, 10 years
ago. You wouldn't have thought that 20 years ago when you were getting someone to dub you a copy of it on VHS.
I know,
right?
When it was called Make Them Die Slowly.
Yeah.
So yeah, check it out. And there's one other movie I just wanted to quickly mention, just because I don't want to give anything away. It's another one of those ones where it's best to go in totally blind. But I've been hearing a lot about Adam Wingard's The Guest from 2015. This is his follow-up to You're Next.
Yep.
And wow, this is a great movie. So it's got Mila Monroe, Mika Monroe, the girl from It Follows. She's the star, along with anyway, I didn't write any notes because I knew I didn't want to talk a lot about this, but I do recommend it if you're, I don't even want to even really say what genre this is, but if you liked Your Next, you'll like this a lot.
It really shows this
guy is going to be something else, because, I mean, the leap that he's gone from each movie to the next one, he's just improving so much, and I think it's, I'm really looking forward to what he's got coming up, because it's just, the movies are getting slicker, but they're still super cool, and yeah, this one had a lot of twists and turns, and it handles like a pro. So definitely check out The Guest, even though it's a terrible title and a terrible cover. Absolutely check it out.
I will.
Yeah, good. You bought me the DVD.
I Blu-ray.
Dollarama doesn't always
Dollarama suck. Had The Guest on Blu-ray for $3. Yeah. Go figure. But Exit Speed, man.
No. All right, so we're going to now move out of that section after like probably an hour and something.
Hour 12.
And we're going to start talking about some monsters.
Let's talk about some monsters.
So, like I said earlier, I mean, I approached this just kind of thinking of monsters that kind of made an impression on me, but we're not going to just talk about the standard. Like, I didn't really go there with, like, you know, Frankenstein and the Mummy and stuff like that. And I also didn't go there with Harryhausen, which I could have.
Yeah. I tried to pick movies that were a little bit off the beaten track, like movies that like people who didn't grow up in my era might not know.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what my agenda was going in. 'Cause when I was making my list, I realized that a good majority of what I wrote, what I picked, was from the 80s.
I figured you would.
Well, it's mostly because I have a thing where I'm not into CG. Yeah. So, and it's, you know, there's not a lot of practical effects out there in modern movies. So, you know, I'd considered for a while putting The Descent on there, the monsters from The Descent, like those cave dwelling albino kind of creatures.
They're on my list. Yeah.
But I wasn't quite sure how tenuous that would be as a monster. Like, I was like, well, it counts, but I'm not sure if I want to put them on there because they are pretty awesome. Like, they're pretty amazing.
They're totally awesome. They're pretty amazing crawlers.
Monsters. Yeah. But I just went with stuff that I had, you know, made, like you said, an impression on me when I was, like, first getting into my heavy diet of watching monster movies and all kinds of things like that. Like, these are just, my list is basically things where I saw them and I was like, either was like, that thing scares me or that thing's really cool.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, like, I was also trying to avoid things that, like, I thought we'd maybe do an episode on.
Right.
So, like I said, I mean, I totally left Harryhausen out of it completely because I figure we're going to be doing a Harryhausen episode at some point. I also, you know, left out, you know, things like werewolves. I was a little on the fence on, like, alien creatures and stuff like that. But, you know, we might have gone off these things a little bit, but we're just trying to give you an idea of where we're coming from. I also wasn't necessarily going with my favorites. They were more just ones that I thought were worth talking about. Because maybe not everyone knows about them. I mean, because some of my favorites... everyone does know about.
Right. Yeah.
That's why they're favorites.
Well, that's like me. I tried to, like, you know, I could have easily said, okay, what's the best monsters? What's the best monsters in that I can think of? And obviously I'm going to say The Thing.
Yeah.
You know, or something like that. That's something everyone knows.
But not everyone knows. And that was kind of my point at the beginning.
But you know what I mean? Like, that's one that's more common.
Yeah.
Amongst genre fans. So that's why I tried to pick movies that were a little bit like movies that are, you know, a couple of movies I have on here are only available on VHS.
Really?
You know,
yeah, I've got a few like that too.
So it's like, I just tried to pick things that I have reasoning behind them. Some of them are my favorite monsters for wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we're picking up your blinds. But you know, generally, I tried to pick things that I thought were fun or made an impression on me and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, there's looking at my list, there are a couple monsters that actually scared me. So we'll get into that.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to go first?
Well, I'm going to say the one that it's not a monster movie, but it's got a monster in it that I really liked. And I just recently remembered that this had a monster in it when I was thinking about this topic is 1986's Trick or Treat.
Okay.
At its heart is a, you know, heavy metal musician brought back from the dead to kill people kind of movie starring Mark Price from Family Ties. He played Skippy on Family Ties. And, you know, he's this metal freak who he plays the record backwards and it brings back his recently deceased heavy metal icon idol, Sammy Kerr, right?
Yeah.
But there's a scene in the movie where it's just a really quick scene where... the girl he really likes from school is like sitting kind of on a lover's lane kind of situation where she's sitting in the back seat of a car, like by the water, and it's nighttime. And, she's listening to Sammy Kerr on her headphones. So the music is actually makes her like get kind of orgasmic because it gives off like this green kind of like, you see this green kind of mist running over her body and she's getting kind of like worked up about it. So she's like kind of, you know, getting into it and, you know, getting kind of horny from this music. And, you know, she opens her, she's getting really excited and she thinks she feels someone there. And when she opens her eyes, there's this like really quick cut of this like goblin looking creature, like kind of straddling her with this giant tongue coming at her. And I remember seeing this movie back when they had still free previews of the movie channels. Like, it's around the same time I saw Maximum Overdrive and all that. And I just remember that scene sticking with me where it's like, that monster's pretty cool. and he gets all the girls. So I just thought that was a cool, like, little thing to have, like, this movie about, generally about this, like, dead heavy metal musician that rips off Carrie in the finale, but also has all this other stuff, just to randomly throw a monster in there.
Yeah.
And it looks kind of cool because it's got, like, a total goblin face. Like, you know how you see those statues on the edges of high-rise buildings, right, and stuff? Kind of looks like one of those, but it's got this really long Gene Simmons-type tongue.
Really?
Yeah, it actually looks really cool.
I'm just picturing Large Marge or something.
No, it's not Large Marge, dude. Huh. But yeah, I wanted to mention that quick because that's like, it's not one that's like a monster movie, but the monster in it does actually stick in my brain from that movie for sure.
Cool. All right. Well, now I'm like a little confused because I've got all these, like, I don't know whether they're mainstream or not. So I'm just going to skip this whole first page.
Okay.
And I'm going to go to page two.
What do you mean if you know they're mainstream or not?
What do you mean?
Well, like, what's an example?
Well, I've got the dog from The Thing.
Yeah, okay.
So, like,
I kind of left that out because I thought most people who listen to this podcast would know the Thing, right?
All
right,
I've got The Descent, the crawlers from The Descent.
Yep.
All right.
Well, we could talk about the crawlers in The Descent. Like,
no. No. No.
No. Okay, fine.
Okay, let's talk about... Okay, I'm going to talk about a newer movie.
Okay.
Because I think these monsters are really cool.
Okay.
So this was a movie from 2011 that I know you've seen called Attack the Block.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the creatures in this movie. So it's kind of an alien movie.
Yeah.
But there was these... So it's a movie about, like, a town in England. I mean, it's probably London, actually. And there's, like, an attack on the block.
Wow, dude.
Anyway, it's, these creatures,
no, what it is it's this area of the city where it's kind of like welfare apartments in a way.
Yeah, it's like the projects.
Yeah, it's kind of like the projects, and it's got all these, like, kind of kids in it, like teenagers who are kind of like, you know, juvenile delinquents.
Yeah.
And these alien creatures come down.
Well, they're just a gang there.
Yeah, they're kind of like a gang, yeah. And and these alien creatures come down and, you know, they have to end up fighting them.
Yeah.
To save the block, as it were.
Yeah, and the lead guy is played by John Boyega, actually, who's in the new Star Wars movies.
Yeah.
He's, what's his name? Finn. In the new Star Wars movie. You still haven't seen the new Star Wars movie?
No, I haven't.
That's okay. Anyway, the creatures in this are really cool because they're almost like rugs. They have this, I don't even know how to describe them. They're kind of like dogs, yeah. But they've got this like weird black fur that's kind of like a shag carpet almost.
Yeah.
But like a really long one. And then they've got this like bright, like fluorescent teeth. And no, you don't really see eyes or anything else. So it's just like these like black running.
They're like shadow
mops.
Creatures.
Yeah, with these weird Dayglo mouths. So I thought they were really effective and very memorable. I mean, yeah. I remember when I saw Attack the Block, I enjoyed the movie quite a bit, but I was really taken by the monsters just because they felt so original. And they were one of the first ones I thought of when I was thinking about this episode. So. Yeah, those are the alien mop dog Dayglo creatures from Attack the Block.
Yeah, they were pretty cool. Like, I don't really tend to like a lot of CG, but I thought those ones were well done. Like,
they weren't CG always. Like, there were some real ones, I think.
There's a few practicals?
Yeah, I think so.
There yeah, I thought they were pretty cool because they were, like, really sleek and, like, fast.
Yeah.
And, you know, they look kind of like porcupine-y.
Yeah, but they're
like a porcupine dog kind of mix in a way.
And those weird mouths, yeah. It was like this green, it was weird.
I think that movie's worth seeing anyway, it's regardless of what movie, the monsters look like. Like Attack the Block's a fun movie.
Yeah.
Another movie, I'm going to briefly touch on this one too, because last episode we talked a little bit more at length about it because I had recently watched it, but it reminded me of how cool I think the monster is in it, is Troma's Class of Nukem High.
Right.
We talked about the monster kind of. He's kind of like this spiky, large green creature who, like, he's kind of, he's got like a big toothy maw that like drips this like toxic waste, and you know, he just goes around killing all the Cretans, like the gang members in it. And I just think it looks really cool for like, because Troma wasn't making like high budget movies at the time, but they really focused on having good effects in their 80s stuff. Like we talked about Toxic Avenger in the past and how those effects were really well done. I thought the effects in Class of Nukem High were really great too.
Yeah.
And I thought that them throwing in this like giant mutated monster at the end was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And I found out that it actually wasn't complete when they were filming the movie. Like the effects guys,
so surprised.
The effects guys weren't quite done with it. So that's why you only see it in like small, like bits and pieces of it here and there. Like you'll see a tentacle whip out, or you'll only see certain, you know, angles of it and everything, 'cause it wasn't a finished product. Huh. But considering that, it looks pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
Like, I really like this monster. It's been a monster that I have always thought about when I think of, like, monster movies, even though Class Nukem High is generally not a monster movie.
Right.
So, I'm kind of hitting the ones that aren't really monster movies first, because they all have monsters in them that are not really, like, the main focus of the movie, but when they pop up in that movie, you're just kind of like, holy shit, that looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, that's what I'm kind of going for with these first few movies here.
I know. I don't know why. Another one I thought of when I was thinking of the topic, but I didn't write down. But another Troma movie was like that penis monster in Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah,
like,
right.
And it makes an impression, right? Like I guess those kind of practical monsters.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, there's movies where, like, another one that I wrote down is, it's a movie that's not a monster movie, but it's the Beastmaster. Don Coscarelli's the Beastmaster. And I saw this movie when I was really young, and there's these like fucking monsters in it that like envelop a character. They're like these bat creatures, and they just wrap themselves around them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you just see the person's bones fall out the bottom because it like totally
shit. I haven't seen that movie in so long.
Totally disintegrated them. Like I talked about this on the Sword and Sorcery episode way back when. But those things are cool too.
Yeah, those are really
like,
cool.
This is what I'm talking about. These are like monsters that I'm like, who came up with that? That's a really cool idea. Like a bat creature that just will like get you caught in its like leathery wings and just turn you into mush. That's like so it's kind of scary.
Those are wicked.
And like in a sword and sorcery movie like that, like they had monsters in those, but they were always standard, like, you know, hydras, and you know, in Conan it would be like a giant snake or whatever.
Yeah,
like in Beastmaster they had this fucking thing where you're like, you're just looking at it going, I don't want to run into one of those anytime. And you know, I was very impressionable when I saw Beastmaster the first time, and that's still sticking with me to this day. Like, I'm a 40-year-old man, and I'm still like, oh, that thing in Beastmaster creeps me out.
You're still scared it's going to come into your room?
Well, no, but it just creeps me out still. I still think it's a really effective monster.
No, it's a great monster. I really want to watch Beastmaster again now.
Yeah, man, Beastmaster's sweet.
Is that on a Blu-ray?
Not yet.
Damn.
I wish. I've got the DivX Anchor Bay DVD.
DivX.
So. DivX. You know, when they were trying to double dip and justifying it by calling it DivX?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you can tell we're collector nerds when we talk about DivX in the middle of a monster episode.
Yeah.
All right. Your nerd laugh.
Okay. The next one I'm going to talk about is from a 1987 movie called Evil Spawn.
Yep.
And this movie is also known as Alien Within in a recut version. Anyway, I like Evil Spawn better, so we're going to talk about Evil Spawn. So directed by Kenneth J. Hall, starring Bobby Breese, who I don't know why horror fans all seem to know the name Bobby Breese, but we don't really, she didn't really do a hell of a lot.
Was it, what was she, what else was she in? Was she in?
She was in Mausoleum, I think, or something. Hmm. I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't really matter because this is the movie that I remember her from. So that's all that really matters. Anyway, she plays, it's just kind of like a take on Wasp Woman in a way, but she plays this aging actress who gets this serum from Don Wildsmith, and she's told if she takes the serum, then it will make her look younger. So she takes the serum, and yeah, it makes her look younger, but it also turns her into a fucking wasp monster. Right. And I like, you know, we talked about Stung last week, and I kind of like these giant bug creature features, and it's pretty cool seeing someone become turn into a monster, which something we don't see a ton of, like, cause sometimes monsters just sort of show up, but I like the whole transformation aspect of it. But this one's really fun, and we don't see a lot of the creature, but it's definitely a memorable monster from that era. And there's a pretty great scene where it kills, like, this woman after she went skinny dipping in the swimming pool, and then kills a few other people. But it's just one of those cool little low budget monsters that, you know, reminds you of a lot of, like, Roger Corman days. And I think it's a fun one, and it's always sort of stuck out to me.
So, speaking of low budget monsters, and because your last movie was called Evil Spawn, I'm going to talk about the Deadly Spawn.
Yeah,
because I love the Deadly Spawn. It's so good. Like, this is a movie that was made for next to nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bunch of guys who are like, let's make a monster movie. Let's set it in this farmhouse, and let's have this monster in the basement, which is kind of like an alien / monster creature, attack everyone in the house. And, yeah, like, you know, it's got the monster, like, flinging guys out windows and just stuff like that. And I love the monster Deadly Spawn so much that I bought a t-shirt with a monster from Deadly, really? Spawn on it. It's like this weird giant tentacled creature with, like, three different heads and this big toothy mouth, and it just looks super cool. And it's like, when you consider the budget level of this movie, the fact that they managed to pull this monster off and actually for it to be, like, that effective, like, it's a pretty effective monster.
Yeah.
Is a feat. Like, that's, like, one of the wonder. The Deadly Spawn, I've always said, is one of the wonders of, like, early 80s low budget filmmaking, because it's a movie that was made for next to nothing but has stood the test of time. It's like a 33 year old movie, but I still love it. And I love the monster, but I love the movie in general. It's just a fun movie set in a farmhouse. You know, the monster's in the basement, and it comes up and kills people and goes back to the basement.
Yeah.
But it looks really sweet.
Yeah, I got to watch that again. It's another one of those movies, Night of the Creeps, that I just never seem to be able to get behind.
Yeah.
I think I enjoyed it better last time I saw it, but it's never really made an impression on me. But the creature certainly did.
Yeah, like, the creature's just like, it's kind of like this, it's kind of like the main, it's like a three-headed monster, kind of, because it's like the main one is, like, larger than the two on each side.
Yeah.
But they're all kind of the same thing. They're like this cylindrical kind of, you know, being with just, like, this really giant mouth of teeth.
Yeah.
You know, and, like, when I don't have nightmares much about monsters that often, but usually when I do, they're kind of vague and toothy. So this kind of, like, goes into that, like,
vague and toothy,
you know, vague, like, they're kind of like, you don't really see anything.
Do you mean
about
fog?
Not quite fog, dude. But, you know, never you mind. When I have these dreams about monsters, they're usually, you don't see much of them except for the teeth. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay,
all right. But you have to make it weird.
Well, yeah, it is kind of weird now. Just imagining you in bed thinking of teeth.
Well, if I was thinking of the 2007 movie Teeth, I'd be in trouble.
I haven't seen that movie.
Oh, man, so good.
Really?
Yeah.
All right.
So good.
I'm going to go back to my childhood now.
Okay.
And I want to talk about a movie called The Green Slime.
Oh, yeah. Green Slime's a lot of fun.
The Green Slime is a lot of fun.
It's got the best theme song ever.
It does have a pretty great theme song. And I remember seeing this movie on a Sunday with my dad. We always used to watch sci-fi theater. And The Green Slime probably made an impression on me more than any other movie that I saw with my dad.
Really?
Doing that. When we were watching all these old 50s and 60s movies. Yeah. I don't even know how to describe the creatures in The Green Slime, but it's not like the blob. It's like these, like, it's these creatures, like they actually, they're like giant tribbles. I don't even know how to talk about them, but they're really neat, and they've got these like two big eyes, and they kind of like shuffle along, and there's not just one green slime, there's actually lots of them.
Yeah,
but they can get up close, and I know one of them, like, they kind of like hug you and melt you, and it's been a really long time since I've seen this movie. I just was able to watch the trailer for the podcast. I didn't have time to watch the whole movie again, but I've always thought of this movie my whole life, and it really did make quite the impression. I believe it was a Japanese, it was shot in Japan. Like,
yeah, it's like a Japanese American co-production.
Yeah, and it's got Robert Horton in it. He hasn't done a lot. He was in like Wagon Train. He's done a lot of movies, but nothing really of like that I can point out. Luciano Paluzzi, who's in Thunderball, and Richard Jekyll, who's been in tons of genre movies. But and they're like astronauts, and then they go and they encounter this green slime creature, and then there's a whole whack of green slime creatures, and they're fighting them off. But it's a pretty cool little creature that I don't think, yeah, certainly nowadays I don't think a lot of people would know about, and it's a pretty neat one that definitely made an impression on me as a youngster.
I love the green slime. It's fun.
Yeah, it's a fun movie.
I just, man, now I'm gonna have to go on YouTube and watch that, like, just listen to that song.
I'll post the trailer because the song's in the trailer too.
That song is so good. That song rivals Beware Green of the Blob. Slime. Like, yeah. It rivals Beware of the Blob as like one of the greatest horror movie theme songs ever.
Yeah.
So let's go back to my, let's go back to my trick or treat when I watched every single horror movie that was on the free pay-per-view weekend. And let's talk about a movie you can only get on VHS. And it's not particularly a great movie, but the creature in it is amazing. It's a movie called The Kindred.
Okay.
And what this movie basically is, it's a guy who's like kind of a scientist. He gets called home to his mother's house because she's dying, and he brings all his colleagues and everything with him to this house. And they find out that he has a brother called Anthony. But the thing is, the brother is a mutated monster who likes to live in like the well outside of the house. And it's kind of like, it's not a great movie. It's from Jeffrey Obrow and Stephen Carpenter, who directed The Dorm That Dripped Blood. And they also directed a movie called The Power. So they were like kind of guys, they made Dorm That Dripped Blood when they were students at UCLA. They wanted to make a slasher movie, and so they went ahead and made that movie. It's not a great slasher movie, but it's okay. It's pretty good, entertaining. And then The Power, which is like an Egyptian relic that kind of takes over people.
Okay.
So The Kindred was like their follow-up to this. And, you know, it's got, trying to think what the actor's name is. Rod Steiger, I think, is in it.
Okay.
Or is that the guy from Twilight Zone?
Rod Steiger from The Illustrated Man. And
yeah, that's it. Rod Steiger.
Yeah.
So he's one of the main actors in it. It's got Amanda Pays, who was on, I think she was in Max Headroom. One of those 80s TV shows
God
we didn't really watch.
Max Headroom.
Yeah.
No.
but the monster's kind of cool. It's like kind of an amalgamation of like something you would see in like a movie like Alien, where it's got that cylindrical kind of head looking thing and everything, but it's also like a sea monster kind of thing. So like there's scenes in it where it's like kind of like a face hugger,
right,
at times, where it like will clasp onto someone's face and they'll rash around it. But throughout the movie it gets bigger and bigger, and it's got these tentacles that like burrow under people's skin.
So does he turn into this monster throughout the movie, or is it just...
No, it's like already existing. It just grows up throughout the movie.
But it's the brother of the guy.
It's the brother of the main character that his mother created.
He's turned into a monster.
No, the mother created this monster from his DNA.
Okay, so they're brothers. They weren't like palling around brothers. Like,
No, they're like brothers by DNA.
Oh, okay. Okay, got it.
So, you know, it's got these tentacles that burrow under people's skin. It gets larger throughout the movie, and it's a really cool looking monster. It's like... I remember the VHS box art is like a baby bottle with the monster curled up inside
of it. Oh, yeah, I know that
box. So it's a really cool kind of like the movie's not great, but that monster is kick ass.
Right.
Like, I'd love to finally see a DVD or a Blu-ray of this movie just so I can revisit it and see if I'm right that it's not a great movie, but the monster is amazing.
Right.
I watched clips before we recorded. I'm like, okay, that monster's still cool. But I've heard people starting to love this movie more lately, and I'm...
Why isn't it out?
I don't know. It could be a rights thing, but, you know, I'm holding hope because there's a lot of movies coming out that I never thought I'd see the light of day.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping The Kindred might be somewhere eventually.
Yeah.
You know, if The Pit can come out on Blu-ray, why can't The Kindred?
That's true.
So.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm going to stick in the 60s here for a minute.
Okay.
And I'm going to talk about another, this is a pretty much a purely Japanese movie, but it's, and I didn't get a lot into Godzilla and stuff, so don't worry. But this is a movie called War of the Gargantuas.
Oh yeah.
From, 1966.
What a friggin' goofy movie.
This is another one that made a huge impression. This one made way more of an impression than Godzilla ever did on me.
Hmm.
Now not quite like King Kong style, but like of all the Japanese movies, I think this is the one. And again, I used to watch all of these with my dad.
I feel like War of Gargantuas is more like King Kong than Godzilla anyway. If I recall.
Well, it's like this goofy mix of like King Kong and like, it's like a mutated King Kong.
They're like multicolored fucking apes, basically. Yeah.
But they're like mutant apes.
Yeah.
Mapes, if you will.
Mapes.
But they're like King Kong size for sure.
Yeah.
And so this is directed by Yashiro Honda, who gave us Gojira.
Gojira.
You can't say it like...
And Mothra.
You have to say it like you're Japanese.
Gojira.
Did you see the new Godzilla movie?
Which one?
The
like the trailer for Resurrection?
The one with Bryan Cranston.
Yeah, we saw it together, dude.
Oh, yeah. Do you remember when... who was the Japanese guy? Like Ken Watanabe?
Yeah.
And he's like...
Gojira.
Nobody's like... He's like, hi, you know, what's going on? I don't know what's going on around here. You know, there's some big monster. He's like talking like an American, right? Yeah, there's some big monster. And he's like, oh, no, I don't know what kind of monster. Oh, what if it's... Gojira.
He's just like, so so how's it going today? Have you seen Gojira coming down
there? He's got to say it like super Japanese.
It's kind of like a prerequisite.
Even though he is Japanese.
Dude, even when I go to watch a Godzilla movie, I'm like, Gojira to myself.
Anyway, this is no Gojira. But this is a movie.
Isn't one of them like orange?
I think one's orange and one's green. And
yeah, or orange
the opening
and purple
scene is like this, like, or there's a scene in this movie where this, like, ship's getting attacked by a giant octopus. And then one of their gargantuas, like, comes out of the water and, like, fights the giant octopus. Yeah. It's so awesome. And then we just get into, like, total Godzilla territory where, The gargantua goes into the city and starts smashing buildings, and then another one shows up, and then they fight, and they're so unique looking, even though they are a kind of a King Kong ripoff, but it's like a perfect mix of like that kind of goofy King Kong like Mighty Peking Man thing,
yeah,
mixed with
Gojira.
Godzilla like. You know, Toho style mayhem in the city of like the guys in suits just smashing the buildings down. So it's a lot of fun. Russ Tamblyn's in this, who I've talked about lots in the past from The Haunting and Satan Sadist, among lots of other things. But he's the lead in this, and it's another one of those great Sunday afternoon sci-fi classics that has some really cool monsters in it.
But it's not Gojira.
It's Gojira. Never really made it. I was way more of into Godzuki than Gojira.
Oh, man. You're in a minority on that, my friend. But
there were so many. I mean, like just on an aside, like, I mean, just think of all the cool, like we had Rodan and Mothra. Like all those monsters are pretty fucking awesome. But maybe we could do a Toho episode one day, but it will just be... I think it's been so long since both of us have seen all those movies that it would be pretty hard to just do it right now. But there was a lot of cool monsters in those
movies. I got some of those bad boys at home. You know, I got King Kong versus Godzilla at home on Blu-ray. So, you know.
Yeah, and I have, like, Destroy All Monsters, and I think I have Terror of Mechagodzilla. Yeah. But, Yeah, there's some pretty good movies there, but they're perfect Sunday afternoon movies.
I always remember War of Gargantua's. I just remember the old VHS box cover because it was like Paramount Home Video put it out, and it was like this hand-drawn kind of like...
I have that.
It was like a hand-drawn cover, and it was like this orange ape kind of like attacking like a some other form of like creature.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, what the hell is this movie?
Yeah, I totally know that cover.
Yeah, you've probably seen it.
I have that cover, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's awesome.
So, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Chud.
All right.
The cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers.
Yeah.
It's a fun little movie. It's about monsters in the sewers of New York City. The opening scene is some lady walking her poodle gets sucked down a sewer drain. It's pretty great. Pretty great. It's basically the monsters in this movie are homeless people who lived in the sewers who have been exposed to toxic waste and mutated.
Yeah.
So they're like kind of like, they're kind of like, they have those glowing green eyes and, you know, they're attacking citizens by coming up through the manhole covers. And, you know, I kind of think Chud's a fun movie, and I think people know of Chud. Like, if you're a horror fan, you know Chud. You
is
just
it
know
like
the
John,
name.
Is John Hurd in Chud?
John Hurd and Daniel Stern.
Oh, yeah.
And then John Goodman does have a little bit of a cameo in it, too.
Cool.
But it's just one of those movies where if you're a horror fan, you know the name Chud, but you may not have seen the movie.
Yeah.
And the movie is a little slow at times, but it's a fun monster romp. You know, I like the idea. I don't know why I like the idea, but I like the idea of homeless people being turned into monsters.
What?
I just, you know, you just get that image of New York in the 70s and 80s of being just like run down and grungy and like the homeless people living in the sewers. And like you could kind of buy the fact
don't,
that...
man. In my area here, I'm going to be like attacked tonight.
But you could buy them in the fact of them being like, you know, getting exposed to something and becoming mutant monsters. Like,
yeah.
It just was a lot of fun. Like, we're not going to fucking talk about Chud 2, Bud the Chud, and how much of an atrocity it is. But Chud's a fun little movie. I mean, it's another one of those ones that it's kind of come out. It came out on DVD. It has a slight following, but it's actually a lot more fun than it gets credit for.
Yeah.
So I like the Chud monsters.
I remember it being a little dull, but...
A little bit, but the monsters kind of make up for that. They're just kind of cool. They kind of like are on the fringe, and then they'll pop out and attack people once in a while and, you know, suck them down those manhole covers. And it just looks... It's just kind of a neat look. I like seeing people getting sucked into manhole covers. I don't know what it is.
All right.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could find lots of, like... YouTube fail videos about people falling into manhole covers.
But I only like them being sucked into manhole covers.
Oh, they have to
if they're
sucked in. They can't just fall in.
No, there has to be a clawed hand pulling them in at the other side.
Do you see this a lot? Like, is there a lot of movies?
Oh, yeah. I'm walking on the street and I see it all the time.
Okay. Do they remove the manhole cover first?
Well, you know, they got to be. Sometimes it blows up, but a lot of times they just, like, kind of peek out, like, hey, what's going on out here? Put you down in this manhole.
Oh, my God, Chud.
Chud, man. Chud. Cannibalistic humanoid underground dwellers. If that's not one of the greatest acronyms of 80s horror, I don't know what is.
Okay, I'm going to talk about these three together.
Okay.
Because they all kind of like... I think they all kind of relate to Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Okay.
So I am, yeah, because Creature from the Black Lagoon's like so great, and I love the old Gillman. So these ones all kind of remind me of Creature from the Black Lagoon in a way. So the first one is Slithus from 1978, who's kind of a goofy looking creature from the Black Lagoon.
You got that right.
But I always remember the VHS cover of this. I thought it was a great box.
Well, what was the, wasn't the gimmick of this movie when it came out in theaters that they gave you like a Slithus survival kit or something?
Did they?
Yeah, I thought they gave you like this survival kit for when you were in the movie. Remember how like in the 70s and 60s they had all these like when you went to see Mark of the Devil, you got a barf bag and all this stuff.
Yeah,
like,
Cannibal Ferox was the same thing.
I'm pretty sure they had like a Slithus survival kit.
You can't say Slithus.
Slithus. No, I can't say it. But I'm pretty sure they gave you a survival kit when you went to see it. But I haven't seen that movie in a long time, so I don't know, man.
I know. I've tried. Well, I'm not. I'm just saying it's one of those ones that made a bit of an impression on me.
Yeah.
But it's not a very good movie. I mean, I'd like to revisit it. It's just that stupid Code Red DVD is so expensive.
Isn't it one of those, isn't there a scene in that where it like pulls a dude off a flagpole or something?
Maybe. I don't know. It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It's been a long time.
It's got a sweet box.
It's got a sweet box.
You're true.
Yeah. Another one in a similar vein was Octoman.
No, Octoman's ridiculous.
Have you seen Octoman?
Oh, yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, so this is really...
It's only notable for one thing only, which you'll probably mention.
The Rick Baker and Doug Beswick effects.
Yeah.
Yeah, they created this creature, and I thought this was not a very good movie, so it's about a guy who turns into an Octoman. It's like an Octoman. It's like
Get Out.
So it's like an octopus dude walking around.
Yeah, like you haven't lived until you've seen a someone with human legs and an octopus top attacking people. You truly haven't lived.
It's pretty ridiculous. It's out on DVD. Fucking Octoman's out on DVD, for God's
sake.
Dude,
Octoman's out on Blu-ray.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh my God. So I actually was surprised that Pierre Angeli and Kerwin Matthews were the stars of this. Like Sinbad, like... What the hell? Anyway, those two. So this is Rick Baker does what Doug Beswick doing a creature like 3 years before Flesh Gordon even came along. So this is really, really early stuff.
Yeah, 1971.
But still a pretty cool. It was kind of a neat, goofy 50s style
the
creature.
The first time I ever saw Octoman was on Elvira's movie Macabre. Yeah.
Nice.
So, I mean... A movie like that, no matter how garbage it is, if you have the added bonus of Elvira coming in before commercial breaks and doing wisecracks with her cleavage hanging out,
yeah,
you know, it makes almost any movie better.
Exactly. I'd like to see Octave. Actually, that's, you know, I'm not a big fan of the whole, like, I don't like at all the whole, like, heckling the movie, you know, throughout, like, Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, I don't like that at all. The Elvira stuff is cool,
though. I like the Elvira stuff where she quips in. I wish they'd do more of those, because I'd love to see Octoman with that, but...
Yeah, I remember that's the first time I saw it was on Movie Macabre.
Yeah, nice. And the other one I wanted to mention in this vein was The Humanoids from the Deep.
Yeah.
From 1980. And these were, again, like monsters that are aquatic monsters.
They're like mutated salmon or something.
Yeah, yeah. And they're kind of, so they're kind of like a cross between Slithus and Octoman, but better effects. But they're pretty cool, too. But like another creepy, weird... water monster.
Yeah, they've got like the webbed toes and the feet, and they got the kind of fish looking head, but there's like they have that memorable moment when they attack the friggin country fair, and
yeah,
you know, the scene that rips off Alien, like the birthing scene.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
And so, they're also really horny because they like attack this woman.
Oh
and,
man,
like,
they're so jumper. They're so fucking horny, dude.
Yeah, they're horny.
Like there's like fucking these people in a tent on the beach, and the humanoids are like, "Fuck that shit! I'm getting some tonight too."
Yeah,
you know, they're yeah. I think that's just pure exploitation from Roger Corman right there. That movie.
Oh yeah,
and I proudly own it on.
You want it on Blu-ray?
Hell yeah, dude.
Oh, I just have the DVD. But anyway, there's a trio of aquatic monsters for you. Slithus, Octoman, and the Humanoids from the Deep.
And if you want to see some other early Rick Baker work, I'm going to briefly mention Incredible Melting Man.
Oh, God, I thought you were going to mention Tanya's Island again.
No. I'm going to mention Incredible Melting Man, which is out on Blu-ray from Scream Factory. It's Alex Rebar plays a... astronaut who comes back to Earth carrying some sort of virus with him that starts makes him kind of lose his mind, but at the same time start melting.
Yeah,
so he kind of rampages through the city attacking people while he's melting down and all that. And it's not, I have a lot of fun with this movie. There's a lot of people who don't seem to like it,
yeah,
but I think it's a lot of fun. It's just like one of those goofy movies where the monster just randomly attacks people, but the effects by Rick Baker where he's melting down looks really cool. I'm not sure if it 100% qualifies as a monster movie, technically.
It's fine, man.
But, yeah, I think it's cool.
Our podcast, it's a monster movie.
I think it's worth checking out.
Nice.
So that's like a 1977 movie. So that's still early Rick Baker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I'll keep going.
Yeah.
And the only other movie I have that is only available on VHS I want to mention is a 1988 Canadian movie called The Brain.
Okay.
It stars Tom Bresnahan and David Gale, better known as the disembodied head from Reanimator.
Yeah.
And it's a stupid movie, dude. It's basically about this teenager and his girlfriend who discover that the local scientist slash doctor guy who has his own TV show has made a giant fucking brain that's attacking people.
Are you serious?
Yeah, and this brain has eyes and teeth.
Does it, like, walk?
No, it kind of fucking floats.
That's a floating brain?
It's like kind of a floating brain that just like bursts through doors and like eats people and shit. It's fucking ridiculous, but I can't tear my eyes away from it when I watch it. It's like really silly. I mean, this is late 80s. Who would have thought in late 80s that a giant fucking brain with eyes and teeth would work?
That's awesome.
Like, it's worth seeking out.
Yeah, I kind of want to see this now.
If you can find it, it's worth seeking out because it's got, like, the monster bursting through doors and attacking people, and it's got the main character having all these fucking weird delusional fever dreams throughout the movie.
Oh, I hate that. That's the one thing I hated about the 80s.
It's so strange.
Those delusion movies.
It's so strange.
Weird.
And
Have you seen a movie called The Being?
Yeah, Jackie Kong.
Is there a cool monster in that one?
I don't remember.
I've got a VHS of that, and it looks epic on the cover, but I've never seen the movie.
I don't remember. I was meaning to pick up the Shriek Show DVD of that, but it's like out of print, so it's kind of hard to get a hold of.
Yeah.
Because I've heard good things about The Being. The only like, Jackie Kong is weird, because she's like this, she's like a female director who was making genre movies in the 80s. So, like, she made The Being in 83, and then she made this other movie called Blood Diner.
Okay, yeah.
Which has, like, quite a cult following and is, like, kind of a gory takeoff on Blood Feast. And then she also made this movie I really love from 84 called Night Patrol.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, a ripoff of Police Academy, only with, like, the unknown comic, which is this guy who wore a paper bag over his head and did stand-up comedy.
He was in that weird roller skating movie.
Yeah, Skate Town USA.
Yeah, yeah.
And Linda Blair is also in Night Patrol and Billy Barty. And I kind of like that movie. But The Being's one that I kind of think we should... maybe we should try and seek it out and give it a view. Maybe we'll watch it together. Maybe it'll be better.
The Being? I have the DVD.
You have the DVD of The Being?
Yeah, and the VHS.
Maybe we should watch it.
Yeah, maybe. I'll try and find that.
Yeah. But... so The Brain, yeah. Yeah, giant fucking brain with teeth and eyes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is that your last one?
No, I got more.
Okay.
Do you want me to keep going?
No, I can bring up a couple. I'll bring up a couple here.
Okay.
So I'm going to go a little newer again. And I'm going to bring up one from the TV series Masters of Horror. Because I really like this monster called Moonface. That was in Don Coscarelli's Incident on and Off of Mountain Road.
That's a good episode.
Yeah, I thought this was a really cool monster. And I don't know what he... Like, it's not a defined monster. He's just this fucking crazy dude. And, like, is he a crazy dude? Is he a vampire? Is he a werewolf? Like, what is it? Like, he's like this bald guy that's just, like, gigantic. That's, like, comes out, I think, when the moon's full. I'm not sure what the deal is, but... He's pretty scary. So that was a really good one. And another good one from that series I thought was, and again with my obsession with people turning into insects, was the Misty Monday turning into an insect in Lucky McKee's Sick Girl.
Yeah,
it was another good one. So there was a couple of more recent ones that I thought were really cool. This series got kind of shit on a bit, I thought, and the episodes were pretty...
They were hit or miss,
but it's like, you know, the thing about Masters of Horror, and I really wish this show had continued because it was such an awesome idea, but, you know, everyone expected every episode to be fucking epic. And it's like, you know, the same thing was going on with Tales from the Crypt like 20 years earlier, and definitely not every episode was epic on that show. So I don't know why the expectations were so high for this show. But it's really too bad because it only lasted like two seasons and then it turned into Fear Itself and then it was gone.
Yeah.
But it's too bad because there were some really good, like there were some pretty epic episodes of this, and especially in season one, I thought it was pretty solid overall. And it's too bad because I think there was so much potential because Howard Berger was doing the effects, and every episode was directed by a real master of horror, and it's really too bad. But those were a couple of the standouts for me in that series.
Cool. I picked up Fear Itself on DVD, but I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
I know. I heard it's not. It was well. It was PG,
network.
Right?
It was network. So yeah, it's a little bit toned down. But I'm still working my way through Tales from the Dark Side. So I'll eventually get to Fear Itself. I'll quickly mention a couple here. We're going to talk quickly about The Boneyard from 19...
I was going to bring up The
from
Boneyard.
From 1990. Too. It's another one that's not really a monster movie. It's set in a mortuary where there's these kind of pygmy zombie creatures attacking people.
Yeah.
But Phyllis Diller is the owner of the morgue, and she was like a... like a kind of an abrasive like comedian, but she was like she was known for having like, you know, having that typical old lady look, you know, with the beehive kind of hairdo. And, you know, she was kind of like, even when I was a kid, she seemed ancient.
Yeah.
And she just kept going. Right.
Yeah.
And, she has a poodle in this movie that gets kind of turned into a giant poodle monster at the end.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really funny. And if you see the DVD box, it's got a picture of it on it. Yeah. And, you know, it's probably all you need. But I just...
That's worth watching the end of this movie.
I just think that... I just think the fact that someone had the audacity to make a giant poodle monster makes it worth mentioning.
Yeah, it's great.
Another one that I'm just going to quickly touch on that's also got, just because it's so ridiculous for the monster, is a movie from 1972 called Blood Freak.
Okay.
Directed by Brad Grinter. And this is like kind of a Christian anti-drug propaganda movie, only it's got like this guy who's turned into a killer turkey monster.
Right.
So it's a human being with a turkey head who goes around killing people who do drugs and have promiscuous sex. And there's a narrator in it who's talking about the sins of doing these things that has a coughing fit in the middle of saying this to the screen. And it's
really?
And it's the director playing that narrator. And it's such a bizarre fucking movie.
Not at all the kind of movie you'd want to do when you watch when you were really stoned.
No, not at all. It's the kind of movie where once you find out that it's put out on DVD from something weird video, you're like, makes sense.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre, but it's totally worth seeking out if you can get it, because you haven't lived until you've seen a human / turkey monster going around cutting people's throats. Yeah.
Blood Freak. That's awesome.
Blood Freak.
All right.
It's a good one.
Given
a loose interpretation of the word good.
I'm going to bring up, I just want to bring up the monsters in Demon Knight, because I really love them. I always have. This was the Tales from the Crypt movie that came out in 1995, directed by Ernest Dickerson and starring like William Sadler and Billy Zane. And
Billy Zane's awesome in that movie.
Billy Zane is awesome in this movie. He's like so confident and has like the best lines, and I love him. But he,
Billy Zane in general is pretty awesome, though.
Billy, yeah, I do like Billy Zane. I like the Phantom. You know, I like Billy Zane.
I like this. He made this movie called The Mad, which was about like people being like turned into zombies by mad cow disease. I thought he was really fun in that.
Was he?
Yeah.
I wish he didn't
do Titanic.
Titanic, yeah. Like, it's just like, what are you doing? Like, he changed after that, it felt like. But he was so cool up until then.
You're
like,
not the same, Billy.
I liked him a lot. But anyway, what are we talking about? We're talking about Demon Knight. Okay, so Billy Zane plays this guy, and he basically makes these demons. I'm trying to come up with the word, but like creates these demons. Say they come out and they start attacking people, but they're really, really cool. These are Todd Masters created. And, I just loved the look of these these demons, because they're like humanoid, but they kind of look like they kind of move like the aliens in the Alien movies, and they just looked really awesome. They were some of the best monster effects that I remember from the 90s, actually. The 90s were not the best decade for horror, and you know, creature, it was a transition period from creature effects, practical effects, to CGI, and but this is one that really stands out to me as a great example of practical effects in the 90s. I've always loved the creatures in this one.
That's a movie I really need to revisit, because I remember being kind of on the fence about it. Like, I remember liking a lot about it, but also not really caring for the story.
Right.
Because I remember them throwing in some weird, like, almost religious angle to the story with Bill Sadler's character.
Yeah, a little bit.
Like, I remember there being, like, scenes of him, like, by a cross or something, and like crucifixion kind of like imagery in it and everything. So I'm not sure what that was about, but
it's very minimal, that stuff.
Yeah, like I really am thinking about buying the Blu-ray.
Yeah, I've owned this on Laserdisc, and then I bought that double feature with Bordello of Blood.
I'm sorry.
Why?
Bordello of Blood's not good.
No, I know, but I am thinking of upgrading that to the Blu-ray as well. And I actually heard the Bordello of Blood Blu-ray is pretty interesting, just to hear the behind-the-scenes stories about Dennis Miller. But
That he's an asshole?
Yeah. Apparently that's widely known when you listen to those features, but I digress. Demon Knight, yeah. The creatures are pretty cool in that.
So let's do a double shot of Charlie Band.
Oh, you went to the Charlie Band?
I went in the Charlie Band territory. For two movies. The first one is a movie called Terror Vision.
Okay, I've never seen Terror
Vision. From 1986. And this is a goofy-ass movie, dude. This is like some family where the daughter is like a punk rock girl played by Diane Franklin from Better Off Dead. I love Diane Franklin. I think she was super cute back then.
Right.
The grandfather's like this military war hero who's kind of messed up. The brother, who's like this 10-year-old kid, it loves his grandfather and wants to be like him and shoot guns and stuff. The parents, played by Garrett Graham and Mary Wernoff, are like swingers.
Really?
And the whole movie's about them trying to keep up with the Joneses, so they install this satellite dish, which picks up like this disposed alien creature who goes into the house and starts attacking people. And it's like a ridiculous creation. It's like, I'm pretty sure it was John Carl Buechler's creation. And it's like, it's just kind of like this mass of like different things. It's like this big blob. It's got these two off-center eyes, this goofy looking grin. It's got like a tentacle on one side and a clawed lobster hand on the other side. It just looks ridiculous. But it's like, I love this movie. Because it's just, like, so goofy. It's got, you know, the monster, like, caves someone's head in with its little claw hand at one point. The punk rock girlfriend kind of befriends the monster with her boyfriend, played by John Grease.
Oh, nice.
And, you know, and there's, it keeps cutting to, like, this horror hostess called Medusa or whatever her name is. And it's a total takeoff of Elvira, because it's, like, she's got, like, the cleavage hang out, and she's got, like, the snake wig on that makes her look like Medusa.
Right,
and she hosts, like, monster movies. It's just, like, a fun 80-minute ridiculous Charles Band Empire Pictures production.
Yeah.
I just think the monster is just one of those monsters where you look at it and you're like, what exactly were they thinking when they made this thing?
Yeah.
And that's why it's memorable, because I'm just like, you've never seen anything like it.
Right.
The other Charles Band one I want to mention was Demonic Toys.
Oh, God. I thought you were going to say Seed People. I was going to come slap
you.
No.
Demonic Toys. And it's mostly for the Jack-in-the-Box creature in Monster and Demonic Toys, where, you know, it's got your typical, it's a group of evil demonic possessed toys, obviously attacking people. And everyone talks about Baby Oopsie Daisy the most, because it's like a baby doll that is foul-mouthed and tries to, like, rape all the girls and everything. And I fucking don't care about Baby Oopsie Daisy. I'm all about the Jack in the Box, because he's like, he looks like a regular Jack in the Box, but he's this weird snake creature with like this big, like giant teeth and everything. And I think he's a really cool creation. And I think Charles Band was really good at creating these like small characters, like in Puppet Master, you know, Leech Woman and Blade and stuff. I think he was good at creating characters and then just beating them into the ground. Like there's 12 fucking Puppet Master movies. Okay. It's not necessary.
Yeah.
So, you know, to hear that they're doing a remake of Puppet Master with the guy who wrote Bone Tomahawk kind of intrigues me. But if you're going to look at Charlie Band monster movies, I'd say Terrorvision and Demonic Toys are pretty good. Like, he's got a knack for making memorable monsters in his movies, regardless of the quality of them.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely memorable. I don't know, Demonic Toys, it just felt really short and like... nothing happened in it, but
well, it's basically just like a bunch of people in a warehouse getting attacked by evil toys.
Yeah,
you know, it's better than Dollman versus Demonic Toys, dude.
Which was basically footage from Demonic Toys,
basically with like some new stuff. Like it was footage from Demonic Toys, Bad Channels, and Dollman,
right?
And then with like maybe 20 minutes of new footage. So it's kind of like the Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 of Charles Band's filmography, and. They also did like Puppet Master versus Demonic Toys,
right?
For like sci-fi with like Corey Feldman.
Ugh.
But apparently, like Charlie Band had nothing to do with that,
huh?
And it's awful.
I'd really like to start revisiting some of the old Full Moon movies. I used to love those so much.
Yeah, the thing is, like, he's putting them all out on Blu-ray, right? I'm just like, I don't remember if I like this really, but I'll buy it anyway, just because I have that nostalgia.
Yeah.
For the Full Moon Empire days. Like, these are movies where Paramount had a deal with him, and they would come out, like, I swear they came out once every, like, 3 to 4 months.
It's funny, there weren't that many. Like, I saw, like, on one of the, like, VHS groups or something, like, someone, like, displayed their, like, classic, you know, the classic Full Moon collection. And it really wasn't that many movies. It was like 25 movies. I couldn't believe it.
Well,
like it felt like there were so many of them.
But it depends on if you're, is that counting sequels though, right?
That was like the classic era.
Because you're talking like, you know, Puppet Master, Subspecies,
yep.
Demonic Toys,
Dollman,
Castle Freak,
yeah,
Pit and the Pendulum, Arcade. You know, there was a lot.
There was a lot, but there wasn't tons. Like, to me, I was thinking like 100 movies.
Well, it felt like to me when I was younger that they were coming out like once every like 3 to 4 months. So
I was in the Full Moon fan club.
Seriously?
Yeah, man.
It's pretty sweet.
I got the Full Moon t-shirt and wow. I got my membership card.
Wow, dude.
Which I wish I had done this, but it allowed me to like, if I was ever in the LA area and I was so young that I wouldn't just go down there, right? You could visit the Full Moon Studios and go on set and stuff.
Yeah. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
You don't want to visit Charles' sets now because apparently it's just some dingy warehouse in the middle of Los Angeles where there's all drug addicts outside shooting up.
I'd still love to be on set with Charles Band's direction.
I know. There'd be some interesting stories there.
Yeah.
For sure.
All right. Well, I'm kind of winding down here. Like, I've got a bunch of, like, I'll mention them, but I'm not going to really talk about them too much.
Yeah, I've got maybe 3 or 4 more that I want to really talk about, and then I'm done.
Okay, I'll throw this one out there just in case you have it as well. Quetzalcoatl.
Quetzalcoatl from Cue the Winged Serpent?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't write it down, but it's kind of a neat monster. It's like... it's kind of like stop motion.
Yeah, it is stop motion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is Larry Cohen's movie from 1982. It's about a giant, ancient, winged serpent.
Kind of like a pterodactyl.
Yeah, flying around New York City.
Yeah.
That's nesting in the Chrysler Building.
But the thing about that movie is, if you need to deal with a Quetzalcoatl problem, who the hell do you hire?
You hire Michael Moriarty.
Damn fucking right you hire David Michael Carradine. Moriarty. Damn right you do.
Yeah. It's
Moriarty was always the highlight of every Coen movie. I'm just saying that.
Yeah, Moriarty was great. He was also the highlight of Law and Order.
And Troll.
I haven't seen Troll, but yeah, I like, used to love Moriarty. God damn, we've talked about him before too. Oh, yeah.
Well, because he's awesome.
But this is a fun movie. It was last time I saw it, I found it was a little slow.
I haven't seen it in a while, but I do have it on Blu-ray.
Yeah, it wasn't quite what I remembered as a kid. I mean, the big scene I remember from this movie is there's this girl and like. Nude sunbathing on a roof.
Yeah, and he swoops in and picks her up in his claws, right? He,
like, decapitates her.
Oh, does he decapitate her?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
What? He's got his priorities messed up. Quetzalcoatl, dude.
He decapitates her, and he decapitates a window washer. Or maybe it's both. I don't know. I just know there's some decapitation. There's a window washer somewhere, and there's a nude sunbather.
Quetzalcoatl's got his priorities messed up.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to decapitate a nude sunbather. That's just not what you do. There's other uses.
Yeah. But he's a cool monster. And there were, you know, you just didn't see a lot.
Yeah, that was like in the wind down. You didn't see a lot of stop motion back then.
You didn't see a lot of stop motion. You didn't see a lot of giant monsters in the 80s. Yeah. And, you know, we had a lot of like smaller monsters, but this was like a giant monster, like back to like my Japan talking. Like this was like something you'd see in like a Godzilla movie, but there was... flying around New York City. It's pretty great. And yeah, so I just wanted to bring up that one because it's definitely a favorite of mine.
One I want to bring up real quickly is a movie from 1981 called The Boogans.
This is
now out on like Blu-ray and DVD from Olive, but when I saw it, it was hard to come by. Yeah, like I managed to get a VHS of it that I'd look for, and I'd never seen it, and I'd always heard the name The Boogans, right? Like, it's a pretty distinct name among horror.
Yeah.
Like when you're seeking out those kind of rare titles. And it's really just about like a mining town who gets attacked by these like boogans, I guess you'd call them, that come out of the mine. And they're kind of cool. You don't see them too much in the movie, but they have like these tentacles that whip out and drag. Like I remember a lot of people getting dragged under shit and being eaten in those movies.
Too bad they weren't manholes, eh?
Yeah, I guess if they were manholes, that would have been the most amazing movie ever. They should do like Boogans meets Chud. It'd be like awesome. But I just remember that's a fun little monster movie that a lot of people didn't really get the opportunity to see.
Right.
Back when it first came out. And I think it's got a little bit of a following now, but I really would love to pick up the Blu-ray of it, but it's Olive, so unfortunately it's too damn expensive.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're fun monsters.
Nice.
I like monsters coming out of mines too. It's manholes and mines, man. If they come out of both, I'm there.
You like underground monsters.
I do. I really do like underground monsters.
Yeah.
There's just something about them, like, because... like in The Descent, like we didn't really talk about it, but The Descent to me is like the most claustrophobic movie I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah.
So you throw monsters into that mix and it's fucking terrifying, dude. Like The Descent is the only movie in the last 15 years that's actually scared me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I got to think for underground monsters. Gotta admit.
Yeah, sure do.
Gotta admit it.
Well, I'm going to talk about Pumpkinhead.
Yeah, I've got that written down, and I was saving that to last for mine.
Oh, okay.
Because that's an important movie.
Spoiler alert.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, we can leave Pumpkinhead then.
No, go ahead.
Well, I don't really have a lot to say about it. It was the first one I wrote down. And I guess it's kind of obscure.
Well, not so much nowadays.
Yeah, I mean, Anchor Scream Factory put out
there the There are DVD. Four sequels. Or three sequels.
Yeah, but none of them are very good, are they?
The second one's okay, just because it's got, like, Linnea Quigley in it, and it's directed by Jeff Burr, who,
yeah,
you know, he's pretty efficient when it comes to making sequels. But, yeah, the other ones are terrible. The ones made by, I think Jake West directed them, who made Evil Aliens.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't like those, but...
I don't like Jake West movies, but...
The original Pumpkinhead is really, I think it's a really cool movie.
Well, it was a really cool folklore-y movie, and yeah, they just haven't... It was like one of these perfect movies that could have been, like... I think Pumpkinhead either could have been a really great standalone movie had they not fucked with it with the sequels.
They should have left it as a standalone. Been,
yeah, and I still think it should be more of a classic than it is.
Yeah.
Like, it is a classic, but just I find a lot of people don't know about it. You talk to, like, your average person, they know who Jason, Freddy... Michael Myers, all those guys are, but they don't know who Pumpkinhead is. And or they, you know, this should have been a really great franchise, But they shit the bed with all the sequels. I mean, you say the second one was okay.
Second one's okay.
But, you know, it just, it could have, I think it should have been a lot better. But the first one was is a classic. Lance Henriksen's in it, and it's set, I think it's set around Halloween time.
Yeah, I think so. And it's directed by Stan Winston.
Stan Winston, yeah.
So the thing about Pumpkinhead I really like is that it established its universe really well.
Yeah.
And it stuck to its rules because, you know, it was basically a bunch of like dirt biking, like teenage, young adult kind of kids come to this small town and they accidentally run over Lance Henriksen's small son. He goes to a swamp witch basically who, you know, says, you know, I can help you get revenge by unleashing this demon Pumpkinhead, but there's consequences. Like, there's only one way you can stop this guy, right? And, you know, he's like, at the time, he's in anguish, and he's like, you know, whatever it takes.
Yeah.
You know, they killed my son, whatever it takes. You know, I'm not even going to hesitate. So it's basically, he does that. It resurrects this big, giant, really cool-looking dog face.
Cool, yeah.
He's kind of dog-faced, but he's got, like, these those bones protruding from his shoulders.
Yeah.
And he's just like kind of gangly, but really fucking huge.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I can remember scenes of him like picking people up and fucking throwing them around like rag dolls and shit. And like, you've got a guy, Stan Winston, who's like known for effects. This is his directorial debut. And I just think he nailed it. Like the mood in that movie is really good.
Yeah.
Like it's a very dark kind of tone to it. Like kind of swampy, foggy. I just thought he really nailed it with that movie, and I just think it's one of the more unique universes, and it, that fucking ending, dude, like, I'm not going to spoil it for anybody, but that ending is so effective.
Yeah.
Like, when everything comes full circle, it's so effective.
Yeah, and, definitely don't spoil it.
I'm not going to, but I remember the first time I ever was exposed to Pumpkinhead was at the time I was living in the middle of nowhere, really, in like these, it's when they were trying to establish these like sort of mini suburbs in the middle of nowhere,
right?
In like northern Ontario, kind of. And all we really had was like strips of houses and then a general store kind of deal at the end where everyone went to get their, you know, supplies. And at the time, they were selling horror movie cards. It's like trading cards.
Right.
They were like Tops. They were like, I don't remember what they were called, but they were like, they were all like, you know, they had Chucky and, you know, they had all the known names, but then they had this picture of this fucking demon who had his claw out and it was like carving something into this girl's forehead when she was screaming. And that was Pumpkinhead.
Nice.
But at the time it was called Vengeance the Demon.
Really?
Because that was its original title. So it took me forever to find out what that movie was. And then I eventually accidentally stumbled across it in Fangoria. And then I rented the VHS when it came out. And I've loved Pumpkinhead ever since.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
Like, I wish those sequels didn't exist.
Yeah, it really holds up, too. It's just a...
Yeah, it's an effective movie and it's a lot of fun.
And a fucking cool creature.
Cool creature. Yeah. Probably one of the coolest creatures we've talked about.
Yeah.
Like, the design on that is, like, bar none. Like, excellent. Like, what do you expect from Stan Winston, though, really?
And it was a man in a suit, I think, too.
Yeah, it was.
I think it was actually Tom Woodruff, actually.
I'm pretty sure he was, yeah, in the original it was Tom Woodruff.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, since you spoiled my last one, let's talk about the only other movie I have written down I want to talk about. And that's 1987, The Gate.
Oh, anticlimactic.
Yeah. So I really like The Gate, man. I think it's a fun movie. It's about Stephen Dorff when he's super young. Stephen Dorff and his buddy are digging in the backyard and they kind of open up this pit.
Yeah.
That unleashes these demons into his house, like these spirits and demons into his house. And it's basically him and his friend and his sister and her friend fighting monsters and demons throughout the night while the parents are away. And I just think the effects in this movie, they're created by Randall William Cook. He also worked on Ghostbusters, Fright Night, The Thing. Most recently, he did the Lord of the Rings movies for Peter Jackson. And the design of them is really cool. Like, they were all practical. It's a pretty low budget kind of movie, but I remember the first time I saw it, there's a scene with like them harassing Stephen Dorff's character, saying, oh, when they built this house, there was a handyman who got like trapped in the walls and died and everything, right? And then like later in the movie, you actually hear hammering on the walls and this fucking handyman is actually there. Like, he's popping out of the walls at them and like, oh, you know, and then it fucking, the handyman's standing there and just swaying, and then he falls face forward to the ground, and when he hits the ground, he splits into like these six or seven little white kind of goblin demon things.
Weird.
And they like run around and everything, and I just thought that was so awesome. Like,
yeah,
these little demon guys that are in it, they're like these little tiny dudes. They're like maybe like a foot tall, but they look so cool. And then at the end, they kind of bring out a giant one of that, like a giant version of that, that he fights in the house. And I just think for a low budget Canadian monster movie that was PG-13, you know, it actually was almost the highest grossing movie the first weekend it came out. It just got beat by Ishtar.
Oh,
and
that's a claim to fame if I've ever heard.
Just think the effects in it were really effective, and I think it's a really fun movie that just doesn't get enough credit.
Yeah,
and just that scene with the guy falling forward and splitting into all those little creature dudes has just stuck with me for so long.
Right on,
like so long. So I think that's probably my maybe after Deadly Spawn and Pumpkinhead, it's probably my third favorite.
Oh, cool.
Series of monsters I've talked about right today. On. Yeah.
Great.
But that's all I got for monsters. You got anything to...
I just got a couple more, but I'll just sort of really fast. Oh, wait.
There's one more. I just wanted to quickly mention Stuart Gordon's Dagon, which is a take on H.P. Lovecraft. It's an interesting movie, but I just like the fish creatures in it. I think they look pretty cool.
Yeah, I don't like that movie at all.
Yeah. It's one of those love it or hate it situations, I think.
Yeah.
I think Stuart Gordon does a really good job adapting Lovecraft.
Yeah.
So, but I can understand why people might not like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a couple other ones I thought of were female Cenobite from the Hellraiser movies. I always thought she was pretty hot.
I liked Chatterer better.
Yeah. I mean, they're all those Cenobites are pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like for monsters, but... I always liked female Cenobite. Pale Man from Pan's Labyrinth.
Yep.
He's pretty cool.
Yep.
Surprised you didn't bring him up. Or is he just too well known?
Too well known for, I felt.
Yeah. The Nazi ghouls from American Werewolf in London.
Yeah.
They're pretty cool. the djinn from Wishmaster.
Oh, fuck. I thought about it for a fleeting moment. Then I realized that... all those movies are shit. So
I just said that to get Chris Coy.
Fuck you.
The Zuni fetish doll in Trilogy of Terror.
Yeah, I considered that too.
Yeah.
That's the only sequence in Trilogy of Terror that's worth watching.
Yeah. We should do a doll episode one day. The Graboids from Tremors.
Yep.
Again, like, and this is, you know, I was a little on the fence on this, but it's like they're fucking awesome monsters, but and then I'm like, oh, well, they're too well known. And I'm like, wait a fucking second. Has anyone ever... I just don't think a lot of people have seen Tremors that are not our age. Like younger folk.
But there's five of them. The fifth one just came out.
Trog?
Yeah, that was terrible.
Yeah, but it was kind of a cool creature.
What's that kind of a...
But he was kind of like...
Neanderthal,
just like,
man.
Yeah, like just like a half man, half ape. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last one I wrote down was, of course... the creature from...
I knew that was going to happen.
Dirk Benedict turning into a snake. So I thought that was a pretty cool one, too.
I'm surprised you haven't bought yet.
Well, because I've got it on VHS and I've got it on DVD already.
But, dude, you can't contain the power of...
I know, but it just seems like a bit of a cash grab.
I see what you did there.
No, I've seen it widescreen, and I'm sure I'll see it again soon.
All right. Great.
Great what?
Great.
Oh, is that the wrap it up, Josh?
That's the wrap it up, Josh. I was doing my...
Okay. So we're going to wrap it up now. So hopefully you learned about a few cool monsters that you've... that you didn't know of before.
Dude, giant fucking brain with eyes and teeth.
I know. And the green slime. You got to check out the green slime.
Yeah.
But you got to be into 50s movies or 60s movies to like it, I think. Anyway, so thanks a lot for listening. If you're interested in learning more about us, you can check us out on the internet at www.thevideograveyard.com/GBWpodcast. And we would really appreciate it if you could go onto iTunes and rate us. It only takes a second, and it really helps us. And, you know, if you leave a comment, it really makes us feel good. And sort of makes this worth doing, you know, these hours and hours and hours and hours of free entertainment we've been giving you guys.
Yes.
Please take 5 minutes or 5 seconds and write a quick comment. But thank you so much. And we're going to wrap it up.
Yeah. Be looking under your bed or in your closets for monsters.
Yeah. So yeah. See you soon.
Oh, yeah. Way to go, man.